Everybody hopefully has had their breakfast and their coffee and their orange juice and we're ready to go. Welcome. We're to this very important effort for establishing a measurement framework for multiple chronic conditions. Welcome to our committee members and to the Hopkins Group, who has been so helpful for helping us begin to develop the framework, and to all the wonderful staff at NQF who have already done a tremendous job helping Barbara and myself get oriented and try to learn the materials. So I'm Caroline Blum, and I'm a geriatrician at the University of Michigan, and I've been involved with quality work for older adults and complex patients for some years. And I have participated in some NQF committees and several AMA PCPI committees, so I've sort of worked in this environment before. We always have fun and complicated days. It always seems like we have way too much to accomplish, and then we always end up with accomplishing something, and I think this day will go just like that. We'll be doing introductions now, but I think first we're going to talk about conflict of interest, right? And
good morning, everyone. I'm Ann Hammersmith, I'm NQF's General Counsel. We're actually going to combine introductions and conflict of interest. If you recall, several months ago, you submitted a conflict of interest form in which we asked you specific questions, and you kindly answered them, we reviewed them, and then you were appointed to the committee. What we do here today, in the spirit of openness and transparency, is to ask you to go around the table, identify yourself, tell us who you are with, and reveal anything that you think is of interest to what's before the committee today. The fact that you reveal something does not mean that you have a conflict of interest. You are merely disclosing. We are particularly interested in your disclosure of research support that you have received, speakers' fees, and consulting relationships. I also want to remind you that you sit here today as an individual. You are not sitting here as the representative of your employer or of any other organization, including one which may have nominated you for service on this committee. So I just want to emphasize that we don't expect you to recite your CV to us. We know that you're all quite capable. That's why you're on the committee. But if you would disclose things that are relevant to your service to the committee. So with that, could I start with you?
Sure. I have no financial disclosures. I do have research support from ARC, from National Institute of Aging, and from the VA. And I sit on the executive board of the American Medical Association Physician Consortium for Quality Improvement. I'm also the chair of the American Geriatric Society Quality and Performance Measurement Committee.
Good morning. I'm Barbara McCann, and I want to thank Caroline for covering during my Africa Life Bucket trip, and I'm pleased to be with you today. I have no financial disclosures to make other than my financial support as being an employee of a committee, and all of my participation in CMS and other national committees are as an individual. The only other conflict of interest that I will offer is I was just recently diagnosed with my second chronic disease, and as a medical social worker, I probably bring a unique perspective to that, and as an incredibly vulnerable patient of the Cleveland Clinic, I have more access to emails and portals, and all I will say is it is absolute chaos, and I bring that perspective, and I'm sure I have a flashing sign that says patient from hell at the bottom of that, so that is a conflict and a bias that I bring. With that, may I ask that we begin with the end of the table, if I might?
I'm sorry, we must use our microphones. We do have people listening in. Thank you so much.
Again, Jeffrey Thompson, I'm the Chief Medical Officer for Washington State Medicaid and the State Employee Benefits. Been there for about 10 years. No conflict of interest. I think lots of committees. The one committee that I do serve on is the National Advisory Group for ARC.
Good morning. I'm Christina Farrup. I am an employee of Johnson & Johnson, a healthcare company. I work for DePew. And my only other interest is I have two aging parents that have multiple chronic conditions, so it's also very much a very real situation for me as a caregiver.
I'm Dennis Haver. I'm a family physician and geriatrician in a private practice in Vero Beach, Florida. I have no relevant financial disclosures except that I'm an impoverished primary care physician. And I have no other significant disclosures to make. Thank you.
Morning. My name is Leona Cutler. I'm the director of the Center for Child Health and Policy at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital, Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And I head endocrinology and diabetes there as well. I have no financial disclosures. My research disclosures include NIH, Robert Wood Johnson, CDC, various other smaller foundations. And I'm on the National Pediatric Policy Council and the Quality Improvement Council for the state of Ohio.
My name is Michael Barber. I'm a full-time employee of the University of Vermont College of Medicine. I serve, actually my main responsibility with them is to serve as the medical director for Vermont Health Access, which is the Medicaid program for the state of Vermont. I serve intermittently on many local committees in the state of Vermont and through both pediatrics, psychiatry, and internal medicine. I have no real financial disclosures to tell the committee.
I'm Emma Hu. I'm director at the Pacific Business Group on Health, focusing on provider and value purchasing initiatives. I have no financial disclosures.
Hi, I'm Andrew Guccione, and I'm the chair of rehabilitation science at George Mason University, and most recently, as the beginning of June, with the Department of Veterans Affairs. I have no financial disclosures to make.
I'm Cynthia Boyd. I'm an associate professor at Johns Hopkins in geriatrics and health policy and management. I have no financial disclosures, but I do receive research support from ARC and NIA and several foundations, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, Hartford Foundation, and in the past, Langeloth and the Center for Healthcare Strategies.
Yeah, I'm Gail Hunt. I'm the CEO of the National Alliance for Caregiving, and I'm also on the board of the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, otherwise known as PCORI. I don't have any personal financial things to disclose, but we have received research funding from a whole array of corporations, including United Healthcare, Pfizer, Wyeth, Emblem Health, Eli Lilly, Eisai, a lot of pharmaceuticals, as well as MetLife. I forgot to mention them. I'm also the chair of the National Center on Senior Transportation. I'm on the board of the Center for Advancing Health and a person that has two chronic diseases.
Hi, I'm Barbara Turner. I'm a general internist, a health services researcher. I recently moved to Texas, where I'm in San Antonio, and I'm the head of a new research center called Research to Advance Community Health. It's a joint venture of the University of Texas Health Science Center, the University Health System, which is a public safety net hospital, and the School of Public Health at the University of Texas. I have no financial disclosures.
I'm Margaret Campbell. I'm a practicing palliative care nurse practitioner, but I'm also an active palliative care researcher at Wayne State University and Detroit Receiving Hospital in Detroit. I have no financial disclosures other than research funding through foundations and the NIH.
I am Joseph Labor. I am the clinical director of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. I'm a pediatric hematologist-oncologist and dealing with complex diseases in children, and I have no financial disclosures.
Since I'm in the QL thing, hello, Helen Burson, I'm the Senior Vice President for Performance Measures at NQF.
I am Q Rhee. I'm a practicing internist and pediatrician. I work as the Chief Health Director of IBM Corporation, and that's my primary disclosure. Them as in my employer. Thanks.
I'm Barbara Zadi. I'm at the Center for Home Care Policy and Research, which is at the Visiting Nurse Service of New York. We are probably one of the biggest providers, nonprofit home care agencies in the country. Have nothing to disclose except for the fact that many of the patients we provide care to fit into this category.
Okay, I understand there's one person on the phone, Daniel Foreman. Daniel Foreman on the phone.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. Hi, this is Daniel Foreman. I am a cardiologist and geriatrician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and the VA Boston Medical Healthcare System. I'm also representing the American College of Cardiology. I'm the chair of the Council on Cardiovascular Care for Older Adults, and I have no financial disclosures.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other committee member on the phone? All right, thank you all for those disclosures. Is there anything that you would like to discuss with each other based upon the disclosures that have been made today? Do you have any questions of each other? Okay, thank you. Have a good meeting.
Good morning. I'm Tom Ballack. I'm the Senior Vice President for Strategic Partnerships at the National Quality Forum. That includes the National Priorities Partnership, the Measure Applications Partnership, and our community initiatives. And this project is very much akin to the kind of national framing that the National Priorities Partnership does under the leadership of Karen Adams. And we'd just like to welcome you here today, add our welcome to Caroline and Barbara's, and also thank them very much for the work that they have been doing to help us prepare for our long-awaited committee launch here, and to also thank Cynthia Boyd and her team at Johns Hopkins University, who is serving as our subcontractor, providing really excellent support, a lot of effort and a lot of expertise into the material that we'll be discussing today. So thank you for that.
Good morning. I'm Karen Adams. I'm Vice President of National Priorities here at NQF. I'm very thrilled to be working on this project. I had staffed the earlier project on the episode of care work, and even when we were working on that, we knew that this needed to evolve to be a framework that would be applicable to multiple chronic conditions. So personally, I'm just thrilled to see this play out as we had hoped. So thank you all for your contribution there. I'd also like to thank our chairs. It's really been a delight for us working together with you and particularly preparing for this first meeting. And if I may, again, to the Hopkins team, really been a wonderful collaboration. So I'm going to turn it over to Aisha, who's our staff lead on this project, and then we'll introduce the Hopkins team that's also joining us today, and we have a few people in the audience.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Aisha Pittman, a senior program director here at NQF and the staff lead for this effort, and I just wanted to thank you all for joining us this morning, and I'm looking forward to our discussion and diving down into the work.
I'm Sydney D. I'm part of the Hopkins team, faculty in health policy management.
Erin Giovanetti, part of the Hopkins team.
Hello, I'm Richard Friedman. I'm a medical officer in the Office of Health Information Technology and Quality with the Health Resources Service Administration.
Hi, I'm Jean Stiller. I'm at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and I'm working in the new Medicare and Medicaid Coordination Office that's focusing specifically on dual eligible issues, lots of chronic conditions, multiple.
Oh,
people over there.
Nadine and Christy and Cheryl, can you introduce yourself, our support staff?
Okay. Well, now that we are all introduced, it's time to get to work. So we'll begin again. I think everyone has the agenda. The first thing we're going to talk about is sort of an overview and what we're going to be doing today. So as you can see on the slides up there, next one. Okay, here we go. The meeting objectives. So here's what we're going to try to accomplish today. We've had some discussion about how much we're actually going to get through, and I actually think we're going to get some key things accomplished today. But here's our objectives: to reach consensus on a definition of multiple chronic conditions. To me, this is job one. This is what we really need to accomplish, and I believe we'll be successful. It'll be very interesting. Refine the key issues to be addressed in the development of the multiple chronic conditions framework. Develop an initial multiple chronic conditions conceptual model and define the domains in the multiple chronic conditions framework. And if you look at these four objectives and you have your pen out, I think hit one, the definition, and four, the domains. It's some of the framework and the conceptual model will have interesting discussions. They'll inform us, and we may get them done. But we may just be really thinking about it and come back to that. But what I think for a sort of concrete objectives, the definition and the domains will be something we really want to come out with today. Okay, this is a group on the committee. Okay. So here's the purpose. The project seeks to achieve consensus through NQF's consensus development process on a measurement framework for assessing the efficiency of care, defined as quality and cost, provided to individuals with multiple chronic conditions. So as we will be establishing the definitions, domains, and guiding principles that are instrumental for measuring and reporting the efficiency of care for patients with chronic conditions. One of the strategies that we're going to take is to adapt the NQF-endorsed patient-focused episodes of care measurement framework for patients with MCCs. We introduced this a little bit on the conference call, and I know the chairs and the staff and the Hopkins people have been thinking a lot about this. It'll be a very interesting area to focus our thinking. We will be building upon the National Quality Strategy, HHS's Multiple Chronic Conditions Framework, and the work of other private sector initiatives, and support the development and application of measures. Now, this is an important one, the timeline for our deliverables. So obviously, this is our first in-person meeting. There will be a draft of the commission paper on July 22nd. I don't know if anybody do you want to say more about that? No, okay. All right, there will be a web meeting late in the month, and another committee in-person meeting in a month, August 8th. The final paper will come down September 30th. There'll be another web meeting in December and a draft framework report. So we'll be done in December, we hope. Then there'll be public comment, framework report, member voting, and CSAC consideration of board endorsement. So as you can see, if you've worked with NQF before in this process, this is an aggressive framework, but I think we can do it because we know what we have to do, and we have a lot of people here with content knowledge. That's why everyone's here on the committee. We just have to do our homework. Okay. I like this scheme, if it's a little hard to see, but this is sort of the measurement framework. It's too bad we can't get a little bit bigger, but it's in your slides. And this sort of tells to me how we got to where we're going and then where we're going. So you can see there are some background materials or some background thinking that informs what we'll be doing. The Department of Health and Human Services has a framework. There's the National Quality Strategy, which I'm sure everyone here is familiar with, Partnership for Patients, the National Prevention Strategy, HHS Multiple Chronic Conditions Framework, which has been very helpful for me and I've read several times. So these are all informing what we'll be doing. Then there are a variety of public private sector framework models. Again, the National Priorities Partnership, which I'm familiar with personally, being involved with the AMA-PCPI. The NQF endorsed patient-focused episodes of care framework. We'll be talking more about that because that's one of the models that informs what we'll be doing. The NQF measurement and endorsement and ongoing projects and coordinated care models for targeted populations. So these are all things going on in the public-private sector. But this last box is sort of what we're going to be doing. The NQF endorsed multiple chronic conditions framework. And as you can see, this is sort of what we're going to be taking up today. This is our outline. We'll be working on the definition. We'll be working on domains. We'll start to work on, I think, key methodologic issues that we'll have to think about for the framework, guiding principles, and finally a path towards key policy considerations. So everything in the purple box we're obviously not going to do today, but we're hopefully by December we'll be getting, well, this is what we'll be getting through. And why are we doing this? I don't know if we want to, why don't you go back one more time, because I think that's important to me, is why we're doing this. Because I actually spent a lot of time on this bottom, you know, when I was reviewing this, I spent a lot of time on this bottom line. Because what do we want this for? Input to HHS, yes, identifying measure gaps. There are a lot of gaps for multiple chronic conditions. This is important to me. Guide endorsement decisions. And, of course, here's the big one, guide selection of measures for public reporting and payment. I mean, this is the world I live in. I live in the world of trying to design ACOs and different methods of care delivery, and how exactly are we going to deal with the measurement? This is extremely important. The roadmap for new delivery models, again, similar, the payment and the new delivery models. This is going to be start to inform how these things occur. And finally, inform research, also important content. So I think this is something to reflect on when you go home, look at this figure. I think NQF staff work really hard, and it's been very helpful for me, sort of guiding the way I think about this. Okay. So I went through some of this already. So we already talked about that. Good. We need the slides. So why don't you go to the next one, because we already talked about that. So here are some of the strategies I think that are going to be important to identify, develop, and endorse and use key quality metrics in the form of performance measures to promote the best practices in the general care of individuals with MCC. And this is aligning us with the HHS Multiple Chronic Conditions Framework, which I think is also a helpful way to think about this. To define and identify populations with MCC broadly and MCC subgroups for specific clusters of conditions and explore focusing care models and subgroups of high risk of poor health outcomes. We're going to be getting right to this in a few minutes. We're also endorsed the meaningful use of electronic health records, personal health records, patient portals, and registries to improve care for individuals with MCC. This is something that we will be bringing up. I don't know if this is really core to our effort, how HIT fits in, but this is something that sort of has to be on the back of our mind. We may not get much to this today, but just so that we think about how we align with the HHS Multiple Chronic Conditions Framework. So is there any questions or discussions regarding our scope and purpose? Do people want to go back to those slides that sort of talk about why we're doing this, or people feel fairly comfortable about? Questions? Okay.
I have one question. On the purposes, you say guide endorsement decisions. Yeah. Can you just clarify what that means?
Well, I can start, and then NQF can help me. I mean, what will happen eventually from our framework, measures will be developed by measure developer groups. And so as those measures are considered for endorsement by NQF and other interested stakeholders, our framework, we would hope that people are going to endorse it, will check back with our framework and say, does that measure fit within this framework? Is that really a useful measure? Is it really trying to accomplish what the framework that we come up with says that measures should accomplish? That's how I see it. I don't know if NQF staff can help.
I actually agree with that, but I'd go further than that, because the idea would also be that there are concepts here that would likely be important enough that they could rise to the level of changing our overall endorsement criteria, which evolve and change on a regular basis. We really try to stay current. So, for example, we've had conversations with Cynthia about some of the issues about stratification and what kinds of things do you think about. We're doing very similar work on disparities now. Do you always stratify? There's a lot of issues here that I think could actually feed directly into we look at all measures, not just how we use the framework.
Thank you. Yes.
So, this is Jeff Thompson. Could you say more about the episodes of care? My concern for Medicaid is that substance abuse and mental health are such a strong predictor of chronic disease outcomes in our part of the chronic disease. So it always seems to get left out. So I'm just kind of curious if it's a medical model only that we're looking at. The other, just real briefly, homelessness is still a very big predictor of people who have multiple chronic conditions. So there are domains outside of medical that I hope we can talk about and consider.
Yes, you're bringing up key issues that we are going to talk about. I mean, in fact, I suspect we'll spend a lot of time thinking about the episodes framework and how that fits. I know in a conference call and then the call with NQF staff and with Barbara and myself, we've talked a lot about how mental health issues, homelessness, and social risk fit into this framework. I think this is complicated. I'm not sure how we'll decide to deal with it, but it definitely is on the table, and we'll be spending some time on it in the next hours.
Dr. Leff and I were just talking before this meeting about two objectives of having a chronic disease framework. One is to obviously have unique measures for that population, but the other would be to have a way of adjusting for chronic complexity in your other measures, the existing measures. And I don't know if you're moving in that direction.
Well, that pretty soon we're going to have a figure that I think deals with that tension as to whether you adjust or whether you take it all together. Probably both things have to occur depending on the purpose of the measure and depending on the purpose of what you want to do. But actually, that fits right in with the conceptual model. We'll be talking about that.
Thank you. As I read through this, the complexity became additionally complex and then quadruply complex and geometrically complex, and I became rather befuddled, which doesn't take a lot. But as I kind of went back out and I said, what should this really do in the end? I think that the end is that doctors take better care of patients, and so the patient should benefit. And if we're creating frameworks that sort of measure a bunch of things that maybe people get paid or maybe they don't, but it's really questionable that the patients benefit, then I don't think we've done our job.
I think everyone in this room is exactly there where you are. And as you look at the domains of what we think would be the outcomes, I think patient-centered and patient and family opinions and preferences are really one of the key things that we're going to be looking at. So I think we all agree with you, and I also agree with the complexity. I mean, sometimes I'm like, you know, nuclear physics, I don't know, but this is very complicated. Okay. Again, many of the things that people have brought up are exactly what we're going to start covering in the next hour or so. Right now, I think we're going to talk about the homework, right? Mm-hmm. And what people thought when the homework was done. And you're going
to
handle that?
Yes. So just first wanted to thank everyone for taking time to review the key issues document that the Hopkins team prepared and then filling out the survey. This slide here shows how people scored the question that asked you to rate the extent to which you feel the key issues should be considered. And we've now sort of put them in rank order, with the first one that pretty much 100% people agreed or strongly agreed should be considered within our framework is the definition of multiple chronic conditions, and we'll clearly spend a chunk of our time today diving into that. The next high issue was prioritizing measures, and this will come into the framework domains discussion, but really thinking about how to identify measures that are important for the MCC population. Then right below that was the methodological issues. We'll touch on this briefly this afternoon, but then also dive further into it in future meetings and thinking about things like denominator exclusions, risk adjustment stratification. And then the following through that, the application of the patient episode of care model to people with MCC. And then thinking next highest rate, it was the non-disease specific approaches to quality. So what are our overarching measure approaches and thinking about those things outside of direct clinical care. And then things that sort of the next chunk of measures of overuse, underuse, misuse, where there was starting to have a little less agreement, considering multiple providers and sites of care, and then thinking about special populations. One thing with special populations, it really relates to the definition that came up in the concept. So those two issues will be tied together as we discuss them. And then thinking of the two lowest rated, we're thinking about unintended consequences and safety, and then payment reform being the lowest rated. So next slide. So here's just some general themes that came out of the comments. There were a lot of comments about the scope in terms of and what level of detail do we want to work. There are a lot of comments sort of stating there's a lot that we could do with this. It's very complex, so should we be trying to do a broad brush of everything or taking a few key things and diving in more deeply? There's a lot of discussion in the comments about provider burden, so how can we approach this without introducing new provider burden? And I think that relates to the earlier comments that everything really needs to link back to improving care for the patient. There were comments that the framework needs to think about the entire lifespan, so adults and children should be considered within the framework and not just focusing on one age group. There was a lot of comments about needing to think about cross-cutting measures versus disease-specific measures, so things that like care coordination versus sort of measuring sort of common disease clusters. And a lot of the comments also relating to the scope are in around payment reform and that this was something that was too complex to consider within this framework. A lot of the comments sort of highlighted that it was a second order in, issue, and it would just introduce a level of complexity, and we already have a lot that we need to address. So that's what we heard from the homework, and we just wanted to get your reactions to this.
So if you put up your 10 cards and then we can queue it up.
Yeah, I understand the issue of payment reform being, you know, something that's really a second-tier issue, but what about in general the issue of cost without payment reform as cost is something that we're going to be thinking about? It was mentioned sometimes in the materials that we had.
Well, I mean, the purpose of this is actually to achieve consensus on a measurement framework for assessing efficiency of care. So efficiency is quality and cost in a sense, right? Now that's going to be complicated for MCC patients. We're going to talk about that because sometimes we don't really know what efficient care is. But nonetheless, that would be our goal. But, you know, I certainly know that the evidence for efficient care in patients is lacking. So, but that would be one of the things that we're going to be dealing with.
On that issue of cost, I know how people are uncomfortable with it. You know, in all the populations we look at, we have the 550 group, the 5% that spends 50% of the cost. But if we delve into that cost, you know, it's largely drugs and hospitalizations that really drive it. It's not necessarily the inpatient or the outpatient. So I'm just wondering if we can look at things like, you know, medication adherence or rehospitalizations, and that's in sync with CMS's goal. Maybe we can stay away from just, you know, what are the top drivers, but look at maybe one of the what are the drivers of cost in this?
We're not really making the measures. We're trying to deal with a framework for people that might come up with that. And from my point of view, part of the people that we're dealing with is that 5%. You know, that's part of our crowd here. So I'm not quite sure how specific we'll get in terms of
dealing with those exact measures that we would expect people to come up based on this framework. But we'll see how our discussion goes. I think, Leona?
My question is partly the process at this point. If these are the emerging themes that emerge, if these are the emerging themes, does that mean that we endorse them and plan to address these? And my specific question relates to the lifespan. I'm a pediatrician, and I think that the issue of children with chronic illness is really critical, but I'm just not sure that it's feasible to address everything through this single committee when it's already a complex issue. So I want to know if that means we are committed to do bullet number three, or it's something for discussion.
To me, it's something for discussion. I don't know. We have always thought that we would do children within the frame. I mean, that's been one of the things that I've thought about. But again, as we get into the complexity and the problems with the definition, it may be that we decide that that's out of scope and there needs to be a separate children. I don't know. NQF staff, do you want to comment on that? That's something I hadn't thought of.
So, I think, of course, Leona, with you and others on the committee who have pediatric background, that was very intentional because the goal was, as we look at a measurement framework, ideally we would want it to be able to address different populations, and pediatrics and obviously frail elders or others would be key populations. Cynthia has teed up quite nicely in her team some additional populations we might want to consider. What we were hearing in some of the comments from the homework was that very important, but maybe not for this first round. I will share that with the work of the National Priorities Partnership and the recommendations that we're putting forth to HHS, as well as Tom can speak to the MAP, the Measures Application Partnership. This concept of life course and lifespan, we've done a lot of work with Charlie Homer and others, is very prominent, and we are putting that forth. So it would be in sync with other work that's going on that is advancing that concept.
The last bullet on payment reform being too far to consider, I want to suggest, though, that providers of care to the patients with multiple chronic conditions are already strategizing for how we are going to modify systems when healthcare reform is in place, because it really isn't that far. It's 2 years. And as we plan for a revised healthcare system, it strikes me that these could be done in tandem.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
I'm coming with a little different angle on that, maybe because I'm at St. Jude and we are not starting with cost, but we are starting with a model of care and the quality issue. So I, for one, always wonder if there is a model of care that is viewed as high quality and beneficial for the patient, then let's start with what is the best model of care for multiple chronic conditions and then see how it fits in the cost or efficiencies. But for me, just reading this and dealing with some of the issues, it seems to me that the models are very fragmented. So how do you tackle all this and say this is the best I could come up with and then look if it's affordable?
Well, we will spend some time on a conceptual model and the idea of a framework, and I'm not sure if that's going to exactly get to what you do because, you know, in the world of geriatrics, we deal with models of care also. So I'm not exactly sure if we're in the scope to deal with that question, but I think the conceptual model discussion will be helpful.
What do you have to push? There, now it's going. Yes, this is Michael Farber. I was surprised that the payment reform had a low response of a top priority. I do believe this is different than cost. Cost is to the whole program, but in my own experiences in view, the management of people with multiple chronic diseases is very time-consuming and difficult. And I do believe that a great deal of the reluctance of providers to get involved in this is because there's a sense that it will lose money for them. As far as, in other words, volume of patients will increase their income, but spending a lot of time with a smaller group of patients wouldn't. So I did think that whatever measures that are picked, that if it this is not if it does not result in an adequate reimbursement for those who we expect to do this, it may be difficult to see a success. But this, as I said, this is different from cost, where, in other words, when a physician orders a monoclonal antibody and he's not providing it, it doesn't create any income for that provider. It costs the system a great deal. So, again, I think that payment reform for those providers doing this is an essential part of success.
Yes, Andrew?
Yeah. I guess I was one of the people who really put payment reform well down on the strongly disagree side of the spectrum, and maybe I can share that, only because I think the questions that I've heard so far about cost are reasonable. I would throw in that chronic diseases cost the patient as well, and that in calculating cost, it is not just cost to the system. I think there's sufficient evidence in the literature, at least in the arthritis literature, that there are opportunity costs as well as out-of-pocket expenses and a whole bunch of things from a research perspective that are either a research career or a research hassle at your individual project, depending upon on what you center on. So cost is going to come up. I think we can do a lot of things before we go, we've got to really consider how to get cost into that. And I think in terms of being pragmatic about getting the task done in basically a month and a half, at least to have a working draft, that seemed like too much. My concern about payment reform was not that what we would do wouldn't hopefully come up in a payment reform discussion, presuming we had so successfully solved all the other issues before that. But payment reform goes into sort of the political fan, and that becomes a whole different issue. That's probably a little bit outside of all of us. We'd all like to think we have this great impact and that people are reading our stuff every day and that that's what's driving policy. Well, it does until it meets the bank the checkbook. So that just seemed like involving us well outside, in my opinion, of anything. We all have our hopes, dreams, and fears about payment reform, but, boy, that's going to be something that none of us can predict, even the people who are directly charged with that. There's a presidential election. There's congressional elections. There are political forces at work. There's PCORI, and God knows what else will come along. So it just seemed like a place we didn't need to go and could still do a lot of valuable work that hopefully would be taken up in the larger, what is essentially a financial political discussion, in my opinion, not a quality of care discussion.
I just started to chime in on how we had put that on the table for consideration. I certainly understand that the reservations about the scope. I think even if it doesn't remain, on the table in the scope of what we do, I think that the reality is now that performance measurement is linked to payment. And so I think that we thought that it's worth making sure that we realize that's one of its purposes as we are considering what the framework might be, in part thinking about some of the issues that Dr. Farber raised about wanting to make sure people don't want to avoid these patients, that we want people to want to take care of these patients. So it was more thinking that it is often, at some level, it may be the way the framework is used as people design ultimate measures, but certainly not wedded to what level we go into it.
Yeah, I'm just going to resonate with that point. Whether you want this to be a part of payment reform or not, it is going to be, because that's just the way things are evolving and what groups like NQF are charged to do, to basically determine the metrics that determine how Medicare and Medicaid are reimbursed. So that's related to payments. I would say, I would challenge a little bit the issue of efficient, do we know what efficient care looks like? Because in deference to Dr. Barbara Starfield from Hopkins, who recently passed away, her research has been very instrumental in showing that primary care is very critical in terms of having kind of cost-effective care, efficient care, equitable care, when you look at regions and populations and quality and cost. So I think when you see a poor primary care physician, as opposed to an ER doc or a specialist, or I like to call them partialists, frankly, partialists versus comprehensivists, I think that there is, when you're talking about multiple chronic conditions, which is basically a reference to multiple organ conditions, you need people who are putting it all together. And part of the challenge we have in our healthcare system is we've lost that sight of that. And that's partly why, so I hope we have primary care as a big part of the thinking in the framework. Other parts that I think are important for the framework from my elucidation are the issue of, frankly, the simplicity of what's multiple. It looks like it's two or more. And what's chronic condition? Like, what is a chronic condition? Is it substance abuse? Is it mental health? Is it asymptomatic things like hypertension and nicotine? Other things that are symptomatic that we don't necessarily think about in the research, like nicotine addiction or obesity, are those in there? So kind of what is that definition? And I hope in the framework we'll think about the national prevention strategy and the upstream determinants of health as we've kind of focused on, because we ideally want a framework that looks at how we prevent chronic conditions.
Well, you're keying up our next discussion.
Okay.
I'd like to hear from Tom.
So I very much agree with the last couple of comments, and others of you, I think, said things that also resonated with what Cynthia and Q picked up on. But just to add to that perspective, if you think back to the landscape graphic that Cynthia presented in what she called the bottom line, which I think is a great characterization of what was along the bottom there horizontally, the intended uses of what we're doing. One of the boxes there is to guide selection of measures for public reporting and payment. So regardless of whether the group focuses in on that at the level we're discussing here, the level of framing, the impact will be to help guide the selection of measures for public reporting and payment. Not only the selection, but also, if you go a little bit further upstream, which things get developed, which measures get developed, how they're tested, how they're endorsed, and so on. And that will all ultimately be relevant in the use for public reporting and payment to those kinds of decisions. The NQF is also convening a group called the Measure Applications Partnership, which under the Affordable Care Act has the explicit mandate to provide input to HHS on the selection of measures for public reporting and payment. That has been kicked off in the last few months with work groups around the clinician setting, around safety, and for dual eligible beneficiaries. And I can tell you, and also post-acute and long-term care, and I can tell you that each of those groups has raised the issue of what about patients with multiple chronic conditions. And what we said to them is we've got another group, this one, that's going to be developing a framework that will be helpful to you in your decision-making about the selection of measures for public reporting and payment programs. So regardless of how explicitly this group takes this on, and I'm not sure it needs to be something that distracts from the broader implications of quality and cost and how they fit together, but this work will be used by the Measure Applications Partnership and others who will be thinking about the payment public reporting aspects of measurement.
I can tell you're ready. Let's go on to really the foundation of the work today, one of the two deliverables that we will hopefully emerge with just with a couple of opening comments. Welcome, Mary. We'll bring you in more as we proceed. Just some process issues as we begin this discussion. We have a targeted time of 90 minutes to solve the issues of the previous 7 decades. But this is why we are here today. If I may state our purpose a little bit differently based on all the comments, we're looking for reality, clarity, and usefulness. This is the basis of all the work as we go forward. If you have terms that are confusing, please let us know, because hopefully we will go from our comments to what we truly want to see at this point. So framework, process, et cetera, are confusing. Please bring that up as an issue. Daniel, I'm going to depend on you to grunt into the microphone or something so we know you're in queue to recognize you. We will focus on coming up with a definition. We have over there boards for parking lot issues so that we do not lose key thoughts as we go forward. So what I'm going to ask Cynthia to do at this point is to set the stage for our work in the next hour and a half, and also how we will be editing before you as we go through the definition, so you always have in front of you where we are. Cynthia.
Thank you. So as Barbara just said, what we're focusing on right now is thinking about the issue of what do we want the definition of people with multiple chronic conditions to be, not for the purpose of defining an individual denominator for a measure, but sort of who are we really talking about for the whole framework. And as part of that, we'll consider whether there is one definition that will fit everyone, or whether there are special populations where we wouldn't necessarily want a different definition but might want to highlight how those populations would fit into the definition, or potentially have just some issues that we might want to discuss around special populations. For sure, thinking about the issues of children, but then there's other groups that may be considered as special populations, and we just want to think about whether they might fit, how they might fit into whatever our overarching definition is. First off, and we discussed this briefly on the webinar, I think that when we're thinking about people with multiple chronic conditions, there's probably a number of different ways to approach them. And I think depending on the situation, it may be useful to have a different perspective. But so traditionally, when we thought about comorbidity, it's centered around the idea of an index disease, and that comorbid conditions, and there may be multiple of them, might influence either the treatment or the outcomes or the course of that index disease, but that there is something that's somewhat central. And I think that this is something that we want to keep thinking about, because as Barbara Turner brought up, I think one of the things that that we've definitely had on the table is thinking about how you might use measures that might be focused at a specific condition, but how they might be adapted or informed for people with multiple chronic conditions. We have thought a lot in general about the idea that people with multiple chronic conditions, that this may not be, if you're really thinking about the whole person and trying to take a patient and patient and family-centered approach, that it may be more useful to think about the fact that there are a number of things in the mix, and that they are not all necessarily diseases, but they may be conditions, and they may be things like homelessness. That's one of the things that we're going to talk about for a good part of this upcoming session. But that these overlap, and they overlap to varying degrees. On this version of the figure, they don't overlap to varying degrees, but we'll show you one later in a draft conceptual model where they do. But that these conditions really exist within the context of a patient and often their family and what their values and preferences are and really the rest of their circumstances. And so I think that in thinking about people with multiple chronic conditions and in general, and thinking about patient-centered care, this approach is probably more efficient than moving all of someone's different conditions stepwise into the index position and then adding them up. Next slide. So in the HHS MCC framework, which it sounds like all of you are familiar with, the definition that is used is two or more concurrent chronic conditions. And we've had a number of conversations with several of you and on the webinar and among ourselves about what is the best way to really make that to come up with an operational definition of who we are really talking about. And perhaps this is too perhaps this is actually too expansive. So for instance, the just thinking about someone with just two for a minute, that the combination of congestive heart failure and dementia, or congestive heart failure and falls, is probably different than the combination of osteoarthritis of one joint and allergic rhinitis. And so that there's a tremendous amount of heterogeneity within the definition of two or more concurrent conditions. So we've looked at a lot of different definitions and really present as a place to start. And then I have maybe about three slides after this that raise some additional issues we want to think about. But really wanted to start with a definition that we think is closer to what the charge or scope of this committee is, as a draft for us to refine and modify. This is the definition from AHRQ. I know Mary Barton is very instrumental and familiar with it for complex patients. They created this definition for a somewhat different purpose than this committee, but so I suspect we will end up thinking about changes to it. But they define complex patients as those that have two or more chronic conditions where each condition may influence the care of others through limitations of life expectancy, interactions between therapies, difficulties in establishing adequate care coordination, or direct contraindications. Next, on the next slide, and what we're hoping to have a very robust discussion on, is thinking about what additional things might want to be considered, with the idea of really coming up with a working definition, and we'll probably use the words over to the left about what we want to use moving forward. And I think that this is a really important step because I think it actually informs many of the other issues on the table for the committee. So additional things that might want to be considered in a definition is the idea of burden of disease or severity of disease or morbidity burden measures. There's not a clear way to sort of capture that in the prior definition. There may be commonly co-occurring conditions that occur with very high frequency with other conditions. So mental health is, I think, one that we definitely want to think about, which I didn't bring the whole paragraph. Actually, mental health conditions are considered part of that definition of complex patients, although some of the things that I think this committee is interested in, like poverty, were not. But I think there may be reasons why we want to think about bringing those sort of risk factors, thinking about the prevention strategy, into the definition for our purposes. But I think there's other commonly co-occurring conditions. So obesity occurs with very many other co-occurring conditions. And do we want to think about ways of how we want to highlight it when it is incredibly something is incredibly common with many conditions? One of the other things that we've thought a lot about, and this relates back to, is there times where the index disease approach may be more useful, is what do we do and how and in what ways do we want the definition to account for dominant conditions such as cancer. And the dominant conditions, as we've been thinking about it, is based on the definition that Eve Kerr and John Pate proposed in 2001 around diabetes, which is the idea that there may be a condition that is either newly diagnosed or so severe or so symptomatic that it is sort of eclipses the care, not necessarily permanently, but potentially for a period of time of the other conditions. So a new diagnosis of HIV or a new diagnosis of cancer would potentially be dominant, but it wouldn't necessarily always stay dominant. We think absolutely that we want to think about What about non-disease factors such as frailty, obesity, disabilities, and this may be where we want to think about things like homelessness. I think that part of the issue will be coming up with a definition of what do we mean by a condition. What really do we mean by an actual condition? But it may be worth being explicit about which things we want to fall under that heading, and in order to make sure that the users of this document know that we intended to include them. And then thinking about issues around disparities, to think, and this is again sort of thinking forward to how measures might actually be used, but are they going to be used to measure disparities? We know there's disparities in chronic condition burden and in burden of multiple chronic conditions. Next slide. I just have two more slides about special populations, and this was just to sort of give an overview of the things we thought the committee would want to discuss, and obviously we can add anything else to that table. But so thinking about special populations, so children with medical complexity have substantial service needs. They have chronic and severe conditions. They have functional health limitations, and they may have high healthcare use. And so a fundamental question is does the definition for children with MCCs need to differ from what we come up with adults, or do we want to think about how, if we think it is the same definition, are there ways we want to sort of highlight to capture, to make sure it's clear how to capture the children that we want to? And then finally, these four other groups are groups that I think there's pretty universal agreement that there's very, very high prevalence of multiple chronic conditions in these populations, but we thought that there may be some unique issues about these special populations that may be worth considering. And again, it may not mean that it merits a different definition, but we did think that these are special populations. They may be vulnerable populations, so people at the end of life, people who are institutionalized, disabled adults, and older adults. So those are the ends of our slides. I think what we'd like to do is to, Barbara is going to help facilitate the discussion, is sort of really go back to the definition and have people chew on it.
You got the slide that we're going to be working from? Okay, the proposal is that we begin with the AHRQ complex patient definition as a straw person, if you will. So let's begin with some comments, perhaps on the first bullet right off the beginning.
Could we ask Mary to give some context for how it came from the doc? Thank you.
Thank you. AHRQ wanted to create a funding opportunity related to how to prioritize care for folks with multiple chronic conditions based on work done by Cynthia and others demonstrating that the challenge to clinicians in implementing, you know, three separate treatment guidelines, never mind the already well-documented impossibility of implementing a full set of preventive guidelines in a 20-minute visit, meant that probably none of it got done. And so in order to facilitate investigators selecting appropriate conditions, our thought process, and really this just, I would say, came more from a conceptual model of what is the knowledge that we need to generate that will help clinicians on the ground to actually change what they do. And so that's where osteoarthritis and, osteoarthritis could be important if someone's Fosamax was, you know, contraindicating the other medication they needed to take. And so that's how, that's part of why there is not necessarily a severity piece to the definition because of the impact of therapies on patients' experience, whether it's the frequency with which they have to take them or the difficulty in taking them or, really that whole universe that is so influential, we believed, on a patient's experience of healthcare. So I guess those were some of the pillars on which we tried to build this conceptual model to contemplate what is it about, how does a patient who has multiple conditions experience the healthcare system, and how could research uncover relationships that were perhaps already recognized, but parse them a little further to make sense of, you know, should this patient with the familiar triad of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and obesity, you know, which of those three should you actually concentrate on first? You know, all things being equal and their readiness to change being equal, which one would give you the most bang for the buck? So those were our hoped for. Again, this was conceptual, really, in nature, but those were the reasons why we structured it this way. And, you know, I think the beauty, of course, of funding research is that the tremendously creative world of investigators comes up with situations that you had not imagined when you wrote an opportunity. So I think the grantees, I'm proud to say that several of them are on this panel, are really pushing this field forward very quickly and will be part of a wave of research, I hope, that will lay out the definitions of this work to improve the next generation of researchers in this field.
Thank you. Margaret?
I like it as a starting working definition, but I would want to see us collapse the first two bullets because they look like they could stand alone. And the two or more concurrent chronic conditions comes back to a theme we've been talking about. If I have allergic rhinitis and mild osteo, do I fall into this condition? I don't think I do. But if I have two or more concurrent chronic conditions, that influence the care of other conditions. Collapse that sentence, and then I think we're getting closer to the definition we're looking at. And in the four bullets that follow, I think we also need a bullet that has something to do with perceived burden from the patient family perspective. Because right now these are more about prognostic and treatment and not a patient family burden factor.
Thank you. Barbara?
I have a more fundamental concern about the practicality of some of this. And I don't know how much that should be a theme in our discussions. How do we imagine the data that we'd be using for these metrics will be obtained? And so I'm just sort of reflecting on the interactions between therapies. I mean, I don't know any of you who use the EMRs, but every time I write a medication, I get about a zillion interactions when I try to do it, and I ignore most of them.
Only a zillion?
Only a zillion. I'm thinking, for example, if somebody has allergic rhinitis and depression, then they are on antihistamines, and antidepressants, some of which can make you, you know, sedated. So is that going to count? And that's the kind of fine-tuned stuff that I think we don't want to go there, to be honest. I think there are some big things that we want to get about maybe contraindications, which is something that came up when you were discussing it earlier, contraindications of certain key medicines. But I think the issue of practicality, priority, we're going to have to come up with some sense of what conditions really do have an impact, and probably the prevalence also that'll play into this. But otherwise, you're going to be nitpicking over lots of little minor players in how people do with health. The last comment, sorry, too many, is the issue of concordant and discordant, which is been a battle out there in the research world, and I don't think there's a right answer, but we've talked about hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and diabetes, and they all tend to hang together. So does that affect the care as much as hypertension, rheumatoid arthritis, and depression? To me, when they don't go in packs like that, for me as a clinician, it's much more challenging to manage. And I think probably May and the long, it's harder for me to meet the metrics. Now, the folks at Michigan say no, and you do better with that, but that's in the VA, and I don't think the VA is the real world. So we can probably have a discussion about that.
Oh, now that we've clarified that.
This is Dan Foreman. Can I chime in for a second?
Just one moment, Daniel. Is there anything based on those comments that you would modify that definition to take that into account?
Well, I put a star next to that interaction thing.
All right, great. All right.
Just as more so than the direct contraindications that you think interaction should stay.
I'm questioning the interactions. I think the direct contraindications is okay. So I don't know if you want to put a question mark next to it. Maybe that's a better thing than a star.
Okay, great. Can I have Andrew and then Daniel?
I think a comment and a question, and in deference to my former employer, I think VA is sometimes real and not real, but a good place to study a lot of these things. Actually, I think the mention of Evan John's work relative to dominant condition, I think there's a clue there that I'd like to throw out, which is that one of the issues in dealing with multiple chronic condition patients, and by the way, we probably should use people first language, patients with multiple chronic conditions, otherwise we're going to be labeling people. The notion is that as a clinician, I have a person in front of me with multiple sets of issues, problems, whatever. If I'm a specialist, I tend to regard my specialty as the dominant condition. And I think, though, that one suggestion I'd make, it seems to me, rather than talking about a central disease condition, we talk about the dominant presentation of the patient. Because one of the things I'm troubled with by these definitions is how extremely pathologically oriented they are. And that seems not to me to be true, and my clinical background is as a physical therapist, as to how most people, at least that I've seen with multiple chronic conditions, describe their illness. And therefore, important conditions to be considered are mobility disturbances, functional limitations, work role loss issues, all of which go into defining the experience of the person and how they perceive. So there seems to me to be a dominant expression, which may be hyperlipidemia, diabetes, obesity, whatever you want to throw into that. And while a single joint osteoarthritis, certainly grade 3 or grade 4, is going to be a significant dominant expression in and of itself, throw in a little depression or some other little problem with that, and it might be as simple as rhinitis, because of how it might impact their mobility, which would then put them at risk for developing pneumonia and then trigger a hospitalization. I think we're in danger of, if we don't have a very flexible definition of multiple chronic diseases, we are going to say things like osteoarthritis and rhinitis don't count. Well, maybe they don't in a research study where they'll be excluded. Okay, or in a secondary data analysis where we'll just be dropping people with certain ICD-9. But from, I think, from a clinical perspective, and particularly things that are near and dear to my heart, like mobility disturbances, which to me are a major part of at least several of those special populations, I think we need a more non-pathology-oriented notion of what a chronic condition is, what a comorbid condition is when you got one of these things, what else goes along with it, and what makes your life really miserable as a patient. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is the mobility, functional, role loss issues. Mm-hmm. And that's not coming out in any of this. And so the interactions between therapies or something which is life-threatening, it's not dying from a chronic disease is fine. It's living with it. That's the hard part. Mm-hmm. And I think any patient would tell us that. So, anyway, I'll be quiet and...
We need it. Is there a particular modification or bullet that you would add that would represent that?
Well, to me, it's not only limitations of life expectancy, but functional and activity limitations and role disturbance,
excellent,
which are absolutely critical to understanding chronic illness.
Right.
And that's not there at all. And therapies has got to mean more than just pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we should think that.
But in the context of where you only see life expectancy, mortality, there's a whole lot of us providers that don't do that.
All right. And so we would add something generally at this point and role too.
Yeah, I think role loss is risk for role loss is an extremely important chronic illness issue.
One thing, functional activity, functional status.
Functional status, activity limitation
okay,
is very
good.
Popular in the international
right.
literature these days.
Okay, good. Dan?
Thank you. So I'm at a disadvantage because I'm not seeing everything everyone else in the room is seeing. But I basically want to resonate with a theme that was just brought up. I think the notion that medication should or should not be included, I think should also be articulated with perspective that so many of the dimensions of illness are born out of therapy, and the things that are done by the partialist, I love that word, the specialist that you, sometimes the inadvertent outcomes that are so much more predictable in patients with multiple morbidities at the onset. And one of the points that was raised earlier, I think, I just want to weigh in at this point to say that the motivation of each clinician is terribly relevant, as I see it, because the cardiologist who sees many patients that are have many other illnesses is basically biased by his or her training to see the cardiac picture. And he or she may not really weigh in with the concern about the back ache pain or the susceptibility to falls that are just looming as a result of the therapy that's meant by all means for the best of the patient, but may more likely have inadvertent outcomes given the context of describing.
Thank you. Dennis?
I think that all of us have chronic conditions. They include growing up, aging, getting through the day, stress, bad relationships, difficult times. I can't think that there are really anybody I know or I take care of who is not in some formulation going to have multiple chronic conditions. So I think that, you know, philosophically, we kind of have to think, do we want to create a framework that includes kind of everybody? Okay? And so my off-the-top sense is no, we don't. Maybe we do, but kind of no, we don't. I really like what Mary said about sort of exploring creative things about what can we learn. And so one of the thoughts that came to my mind was that as a framework, we could say what we want to focus on is looking at conditions which have identified guidelines, and then can we amalgamate two or three or four of conditions which have guidelines. So, for example, being an adolescent, which is a dominant condition, I can tell you I've had three of them. That's a dominant condition by any definition. But that is not necessarily a guideline. You know, that's a life event. So that looking at the combination of things which have guidelines and then what can we do to make those guidelines simpler, meld together, maybe better. And then if you will indulge me, I have something I'd like to project. Do you have that, Nadine? So that what I'd like to just sort of muddy the waters for you a little bit and give you a new acronym. And the new acronym is CCCB, which is Counting Chronic Condition Beans. And so I'm going to give you something that I thought of that might
be beans.
Beans. We're going to be bean counters. And the way that ill-defined conditions that don't have a clear pathologic test, you kind of diagnose them like rheumatoid arthritis used to be, like rheumatic fever is diagnosed, where you have so many from column A and so many from column B, and you count up points and beans. So I have a thing which hopefully is going to be up here soon that's going to propose that we assign a point value to conditions based upon how much time they take the patient to get the condition taken care of. So if there's something which is relatively minor and requires episodic care, that it gets a half a point. Okay? And if there's something which requires routine care, it's a chronic illness, like, say, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, osteoarthritis, and but the chronic care is 4 office visits or less per year, that gets 1 point. Okay, there we go. So 1 point. You get 2 points if you have something which otherwise has 1 point, but you have exacerbations or complications. So, for example, a hospitalization, or it takes 6 to 12 office visits. That should be, it says hour, it should be per year. Or there are more than 2 ER visits, or the physician has to get a consultation from another physician. But now that condition has 2 points. And then you can hit the top, 3 points, which is that you have something which would qualify for number 2, but now it's even more intense. So, for example, there are more than 2 hospitalizations in a year for that condition, that there are more than 12 office visits a year for that condition, that there are more than 6 absences from work or daily activity caused by that condition in a year. So my proposal was that you have to have more than 3.5 points to be in the rubric of suffering from multiple chronic conditions. And it's kind of a functional thing, you know. So if you are spending that much time going to doctors, then your life is going to be impacted. So it's a little different approach, but I'll just put it out there for comment.
Okay. Thank you. Sir, at the very end. I'm sorry, I can't see. Go ahead.
This is Jeff Thompson. Just a concern from the Medicaid, just your burden to put up with me, is everything I hear is sort of a Medicare focus, the hypertensive, hyperlipidemic, obese, you know, elderly. And for my...
Mm-mm.
Well, whatever. But so in my world...
You're not agreeing to be elderly.
But in my world of cost, in my world of prevalence, it's more of the diabetic, schizophrenic, alcoholic. So, you know, on the special populations, I think it's a bias of researchers where there's more data access to Medicare than there is Medicaid or the employer population. So just a concern, you know, to put out there. One of the things, back to the definition, the interactions between therapies, I would change that to the interactions between therapies and diseases. Some therapies are additive, and some diseases are additive, but there are some interactions that are synergistic. For instance, the long-term HIV client who's been on, you know, the antivirals for years, they get some synergistic issues that just blow out of the water as with chronic diseases. Where in my case, I did some homework looking at, very similar to what you were talking about, looking at additive diseases, looking at dyads and triads of diseases. And if you put substance abuse on any one of the chronic diseases, it blows everything out of the water for ER hospitalizations, multiple visits. You know, our costs just go outside the pale. And then if you throw in, like I said, a client with schizophrenia, diabetes, caused by his, you know, schizophrenic medication, and you throw in substance abuse, that just becomes, you know, so synergistic that, it blows everything out the water. So my only thing is maybe, you know, interactions which would be additive or synergistic helps to sort of prioritize them. So I've looked at some of our cost data and our prevalence data, and it is that interaction between a chronic disease and substance abuse, if you look at a dyad, that blows our cost and a prevalence out the water. And then you throw those 3 in, and it's, you know, it is the 550. It's the 1, you know, 30, you know, population. 1% is 30% of our costs.
I wonder if it wouldn't be value to have an explicit definition of what we mean by a condition in the definition, make it very sort of front and center. Because, I mean, I think we all completely agree with the role of mental health and substance abuse. And I'm not sure exactly how we'd want to do it all on one slide, but it seems to me like that would be a really important piece of the definition.
We'll put that up. Let's try to get through a few more comments, and then we'll go back to the definition. Emma?
Yeah, I want to echo what Andrew said earlier, that
around the use of the word life expectancy, it seems to imply a certain level of severity that you're artificially cutting off as opposed to conditions that have impact on functional outcomes, quality of life, and so forth. And I'd also raise the issue of the patient experience around what is asymptomatic versus what's affecting them in the way of pain, difficulty walking, you know, and activities. That, you know, there may be individuals with hyperlipidemia, hypertension, and overweight that they don't think anything's wrong with them, but would come up with a certain level of severity over a longer term versus the near term. And the other question that I would like to raise is the extent to which, Cynthia, you thought about how some of the risk models are structured today that affect reimbursement, thinking about, you know, like how DXCG or other tools quantify a quasi-index condition and then additively rate secondary components.
That was the reason, I think on the subsequent slides, this, which you can't look at them all at once, but they're in the handouts, the things that we thought potentially we would want to think about adding is that this definition doesn't really capture that idea of how you might measure sort of morbidity burden, you know, using the existing systems that we have, because this is sort of very focused on understanding, like, exactly which two things that you have, but I think that there may be times that people want to measure performance where they want to define MCCs based on some sort of morbidity burden measure, and it may be one that has been designed to predict risk of future cost, but it may be that there's value in thinking about morbidity burden as it relates to things like functional limitations and quality of life. I'm not sure that future utilization would be the only reason that there might be value of having a definition that in some way incorporated those kinds of morbidity burden measures. You know, so this definition is sort of very focused on the way that it reads and sort of knowing what two specific things are, and there's obviously real value to that, but thinking about wanting a definition that sort of applies to everyone, it may be that we want to think about alternate things that would also fit the definition. And this is something I think we talked about with the co-chairs on one of the initial calls, so I'd be interested in their thoughts also.
May I just address two things with Emma? In the first bullet on life expectancy, based on your comments, would you modify that?
Yeah, I would lean towards functional outcomes.
And remove life expectancy?
Yeah.
Okay. And it was functional status and roles. Okay. All right. Anything else? Would the perceived burden by patient and family address what you were just discussing?
You know, I'm not sure because
okay.
I think that's a little bit more qualitative.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Then that's an issue we need to address. Leona, is your comment directly to this?
I have some comments.
Okay, just then I'm going to ask you we've got a line. Believe it or not, I'm on.
I don't agree with taking a limitation of life expectancy.
Okay, great.
I understand that it's not a matter of weighing one or the other. They're both important, so it in my opinion, it really needs to be in.
Okay.
I want to ask also if this definition that all these sub bullets have to be met, or is it an and or an or?
Cynthia?
I think it's an or. That you would, and that I think that on our other slides, we thought there were potentially a number of other things we might want to add to the list of the or.
Okay, great. Just so we know, I have Michael, is it Kiyu? Kiyu. Cynthia, Joseph, and Leona. So, Michael. Michael, do you have a comment?
It's my turn?
Yes.
The comment that the concern that I have in the definition that I've given some thought to, I like the ARC definition, and we are trying, but what my concern is I wouldn't want everybody to now say they have a multiple chronic disease, because they do. So even when you look at, of course, there's a big focus on those common ones, diabetes and atherosclerotic disease and things that relate to obesity. But if you have diabetes and you have hypercholesterolemia and you really are just on diet and really not taking any therapy, it's really hard for me to then want to place that in with the usual train wreck that I took care of when I was in practice, which was my entire practice was train wrecks. And so that number of medications was an important, or number of therapies that were going on, because those are the things that as the primary physician really has to pay attention to. And, you know, so those people that are on many, many medicines, I think those like 10, 15. Now, I don't have an actual number in my mind, but what I am saying for us to think about and discuss is that if we just take the definition, and I like the ARC definition, but if we take it at face value, we include a lot of people who really are fairly easy to manage. And then when you start adding on the functional problems, they may be something that's either changing or fixed. And those are also, you know, a fixed disability is much different than a changing disability, because it takes a lot more work. So what I'm, in other words, I think that what we'd be looking at is the management of people that have complicated things to manage. And just the diagnosis alone doesn't necessarily mean it. Then we can even get to, you know, there's been discussion about minor diagnoses, and I guess no one is going to think that allergic rhinitis is a life-threatening illness. But there could be situations where someone has a major impact on their life. They're on 5 or 6 different medications to treat it, and including maybe steroids. So I think that number of therapies is one thing. I also wanted to say 2 other quick comments, and that is, I've heard this mentioned, I'm glad, here a few times, because it wasn't in this packet that much. And that was, you know, we heard the substance abuse, because at least in experience, alcohol has some of the biggest impacts on all of your organs. And it continues to create new diseases for you if you continue to drink heavily. So I think that substance abuse is a real increaser of the diseases you have. Whereas, for instance, mental illness, which is very important because of, especially of its impact on survival of people with chronic diseases, on its own right, doesn't make, let's say, your liver worse, whereas drinking will. So I think that the substance abuse, if anything, needs to be even increased in its prevalence. And then the last thing I wanted to just make comment of in this definition is, and I might have comments on it later, and that is the whole increase in hospitalists in our treatment activities today. And I see this as a very big issue that we haven't really talked about, that we have a primary doctor managing chronic illness, and then we have this person that the primary doctor never communicates with and doesn't know, who's now managing the same chronic illnesses in his patient. And they go back and forth. And each one, the hospitalist and the primary doctor, are actually very dependent in a measurement standpoint of what the other one did. Because if the hospitalist discharges them on many medicines that interact, or maybe not enough, this may create a problem for the primary doctor. And the primary doctor, who is also not has a management issue, may be creating cases for the hospitalist. So I think that as far as measuring it then of how you're doing, I think that the fact that there's two individuals involved in many cases now is an important issue.
Thank you.
Q?
I'm trying to keep it simple. When you think multiple chronic conditions, I mean, we're not here to redefine multiple. Multiple is one or more. I mean, more than one. So there's nothing really, I mean, I almost feel like we should just call it chronic conditions because the S is already there. So why do we have to say multiple? But I do echo the issue that was stated before, that when you're basically everyone. Everyone's going to have multiple chronic conditions. I mean, it's where we're trending. So we're challenged with a definition that will likely dilute things. I'm also helping Helen jump into the queue and tell you what the definition of chronic conditions is by Dr. Anderson. We define chronic conditions as those conditions that last a year or more and require ongoing medical attention, that's a good one, and or limit activities of daily living, which we've been resonating here with a number of comments. So trying to keep it simple, I think I love the length of life expectancy. I mean, I always think, you know, how long you live versus the quality of how you live life. So I think quality of life is important. I'm glad we got those two, so I would resonate with that. I would not be that excited about, I'm not that excited about the interactions, direct contraindications. I actually like the care coordination piece, which no one's really, I mean, the role, the complexity, that's a part of the ARC definition that I think we didn't necessarily transfer. What we're really trying to do is identify those people who are more complex compared to those who are simple. And I would say that the assessment of complexity could be either by a patient's experience, so I appreciate the bottom, which says family and patient, but also by a provider's assessment. Because oftentimes, many patients don't think they have problems. I mean, when they're asymptomatic, they're often, you know, not necessarily feeling kind of the future of what will likely progress to a stroke or to a heart attack. So I think patient's experience and provider's assessment, which, so I notice provider assessment isn't necessarily there, because I think that that's important. When you look at complexity, I think you could think of it in terms of something that affects you potentially daily. I mean, I sort of like how the asthma kind of guidelines are in terms of stages. You know, you talk about weekly symptoms, monthly symptoms, you know, certain exacerbations, and shouldn't we be thinking maybe of something that affects people? Because we can't change the definition of what multiple means or the fact that it's more than one, but we can have in the definition the provision of what we're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the complexity, the severity, and maybe that has some daily impact.
Any particular revisions you would make to this based on yours and then Helen's comments?
Yeah, I liked Helen's comment. I mean, I like that. I did mention, though, when it came to depression, diagnosing depression, it doesn't take a year to, you know, the time frame of that definition is concerning, because you could be diagnosed with depression after 2 weeks of symptoms, right? So beyond that could be recalibrated. I do like the ongoing medical attention and the...
And limit activities of daily living is the second half of it.
Yeah. So I like both of those.
This is Jerry Anderson's work at Hopkins. I just pulled it up. He just said, again, redefine chronic conditions as those that last a year or more, and that's the part Q's questioning, I agree, and require ongoing medical attention and or limit activities of daily living. Just another one to consider.
Modification to anything above for consideration?
And that's not addressed under limitations of functional outcomes, functional status, and roles?
That's not getting there, yeah. But the ongoing attention.
Okay. Do you feel you need to add a specific time frame? Because that's one of the major differences in there. Okay. Right. Joseph?
I'm struggling with these definitions for pediatrics, because if you look, if somebody has cystic fibrosis or sickle cell disease, it's already a multiple chronic condition for me, and yet one disease. So I looked at one of the definitions that one has. So either we develop a straw man for pediatrics and then for transition from pediatrics to adulthood, or we try to fit it all, and this was one of the questions that you had. I think if you look in pediatrics, you can have one chronic disease and multiple visits to different specialists. And I looked at one of the homework assignments, and there is a definition that doesn't go by multiple conditions, but by multiple specialists. So, partialists. So, I think this needs to be taken into account when you deal with pediatrics. Because if you have cystic fibrosis, you see 10 different disciplines. If you have sickle cell, you have one disease, you see the hematologist, but you might have silent strokes and see neurologists and other. So I'm trying to see if it can all fit in one and include pediatrics, and I think the multi-specialist might fit.
Okay. Leona.
Some of my comments have been addressed. I felt it was important to have the definition right up front until you've done that, but I think we have to know what we're talking about. I have problems with the first bullet in terms of identified guidelines. There just are many conditions, certainly in pediatrics, that are chronic and have no guidelines, so I would strongly advocate striking that. I don't see what it necessarily adds for us. The other more fundamental problem is I have a problem with the transition with that second bullet of influencing the care of other conditions, because it seems to me, with all due respect to the people who developed it, that it's sort of a tortured way of sort of expressing complexity. And what we're really talking about is complexity of either the management from the point of view of the healthcare provider, or complexity from the patient's perspective in terms of their managing multiple conditions and daily activities, et cetera. I think that all the sub-bullets are reasonable, but the idea of influencing the care of other conditions seems to me to be this kind of roundabout sort of tortured thing, which could just be substituted with a degree of complexity or impact.
As the proposed phrase, degree of...
Well, first of all, again, I would strike guidelines, and then I would say, I don't know the exact words here, but where the combination... See, so to me, it's not so much of each condition. It's the combination of conditions, or perhaps, as Joseph said, there are certain, exceptions to that. But it's the combination of conditions that leads to a complexity in the medical care or in the patient's experience in terms of the following sub-bullets. It's not that they have to interact. Like, I'm thinking of a child with congenital heart disease and diabetes, and I could kind of say, well, maybe there's a tortured way they interact because they both influence life expectancy, but... It's kind of a convoluted way of looking at it. And yet they're both important chronic diseases that that don't interact, but yet each one influences how the child lives and how the family lives.
Good. Caroline.
That one's not working. Okay, well, actually, I didn't plan to react to that, but actually there is a problem that when conditions do influence the care of the other conditions, if, for example, a person has coronary heart disease and low blood pressure because of their heart failure and you can't give them a beta blocker. So I wouldn't actually take that out. I think you're saying that that there are two different things. So I would actually leave that in too. I think you were just referring to the idea that a condition does influence the care of the other condition. That does often happen.
But
you can't.
Is that the bottom line way that you could... Is that a requirement? Right.
Does it have to be that way? I think it's a pretty important problem in older folks. I don't know. That where you can't do one thing because something else prevents you. So maybe it's a sidebar. I guess I'm not sure. It's just a complete... It is a problem, but that wasn't actually what I was planning to say. But I wouldn't necessarily take it out. I would just add what you said, and other people can react to that. What I was interested in saying is sort of going back to the care coordination, and in that some of the conditions make it,
impossible for a person to care for themselves. So I don't know, people may think this is part of the perceived burden, but for example, if someone has diabetes and visual impairment, then they can't draw up their insulin. So there are some conditions that actually sort of prevent the person from doing adequate self-care, and that may not be a separate point. People may think it's within the perceived burden, but to me it definitely adds to the complexity if the person is somehow prevented from managing their disease, one condition, because they have other conditions. The other point I wanted to make, which is a little bit different, and maybe people will react to it, is, and this has been brought up before, but I just wanted to put it on the table again, And the background to what I'm going to say is when you design, I'd spent a lot of time designing care models and delivery models, and there are different types of complex patients. That's what we're talking about. There are children, there are frail elders, there are different types of complex patients. So if we're going to have a sort of a MCC definition that sort of could be encompassing with all the either ors, can encompass all different types of patients. But on a practical point of view, interventions or care delivery systems and payment models, there are a lot of different kinds of complicated patients or MCC or patients with multiple conditions. So I guess I'm just trying to say that are we trying to have in one definition every different type, because a person can have, you know, the Chinese, you know, they can have this dot and this dot and this dot and this dot, and that's one type of complex patient, this dot, this. So I'm just putting that out there because that's what we're heading towards. I'm not opposed to it. I'm just saying that there are different types of patients with complex conditions.
Okay, I'm going to ask quickly. Cynthia, do you have something that... Wait.
Microphone, please.
I guess one question I have for the group, in part from our own perspective and part from some of the comments from people, is the idea that a condition needs to require ongoing medical attention the way that we would want to word it, or is this a more biomedical way of stating it? Because it sounds, to me, and it sounds like people are thinking about like behavioral health interventions or more preventive, that at least on the table for consideration is that we wanted to include something as a condition that might merit more prevention, so like risk for falls or imbalance, or I guess you could argue that obesity requires medical attention. But so just wanted to raise that for the group. And I guess I have a question in part from for NQF, which is really more of another issue to raise, which is the idea if we build something into the definition which includes how much utilization the patient already has, does that, and are there places where that might become problematic in that there may be incentives that to sort of drive up utilization. So just want to raise that as an issue. I don't necessarily have the answer.
Okay. And Barbara?
Amen. I absolutely agree with you. I would not use utilization as one of the ways to measure intensity, because then I would have an incentive to put somebody in the hospital a third time because I'd made that third point. But I would like to go back to this complexity. Actually, it's Andrew, like 25,000 comments ago. I thought that your idea about trying to think of something that's cross-cutting all of these diseases, and are we going to be really bean counting, and they're back to beans, all of the diseases. We had this conference a while ago, and we had exactly the same conversation at the end. We decided we would propose that functional status should be a standard piece of data collected in the process of care. And we could talk about how you would evaluate life expectancy. We're pretty crummy at it, but I think it's a very important dimension. And then some of this other stuff is very qualitative, like perceived burden, but it could be something that would be information available for all patients rather than trying to get to parsing out how bad is the congestive heart failure, how bad is the osteoarthritis, and our usual way is counting up diseases. So we wound up pushing back from that and thinking about global measures that we apply across all folks and start to mandate that we collect that information. So that would allow us to characterize a kid, just one kid with one disease, but it's a really bad disease. The other thing is that I really resonate with data that aren't also collected but affect outcomes, like health literacy. And we talked about homelessness. These aren't diseases, but they're factors that strongly influence the success that I have with patients' care. And I've been beefing about that when I was on the cardiovascular NQF, where we're, you know, penalizing people if they don't, you know, get their blood pressures under, you know, 110 over 60. But, I mean, I think that, I think it's really important to think about these other covariates that really do influence outcomes. And we actually, in this meeting, wound up saying we should give people more credit if they take care of vulnerable populations who have poor health literacy, who are homeless, who are this. So I would give them points for it, and in addition to points for patients who have more functional status complications. The last thing is I don't want to reward bad care. That's the only thing. I'm trying to think about how to, you know, if I have a patient and I don't take care of them well and they get end-stage renal disease, am I going to get more credit for taking care of a complicated person? And it has to do with the fact that we really don't have good longitudinal care, so you can't really credit anybody with, you know, what's going on with them. But I would still argue that the functional status at that point in time, and maybe looking over time, is one way to kind of dissociate that. Sorry, went on long.
Now, with all that experience in mind, are there revisions you'd like to propose?
Yeah, I'd get rid of all the conditions. Sorry. I would highlight the functional outcomes, life expectancy, I'd probably add risk factors for poor outcomes, including measures of social stability, such as homelessness, and I'd also consider adding a measure of health literacy. I mean, you know, there's lots of other stuff I would add, but I really want to emphasize those things as being paramount rather than saying, is it one condition, two conditions, how bad are the conditions? So I'd be tempted to get rid of the first three lines.
Okay. Margaret.
I agree with Cynthia and Barbara that we don't want the utilization piece as included, because optimal care means there's less utilization of patients with chronic disease. I would like to also see us use the more inclusive language of provider attention rather than medical attention all through our document. And lastly, I do want to see pulled out from functional outcomes life-limiting illnesses. It is known that with multiple chronic conditions, life expectancy is short. That's a given. So in order for us to lead into, from our definition, measures of quality, which include advanced care planning, palliative care, hospice referral when appropriate, I think we have to make a notation in one of those bullets that the combination of conditions leads to high levels of complexity. That's a single bullet.
Mm-hmm.
It leads to functional outcomes. It leads to interactions between therapies. It leads to perceived burden by patient and family. It leads to an expectation of life limitation.
I think we actually may have that.
We have it bundled right now with functional outcomes, and they're the same. They're not the same.
Okay. Karen, do you need clarification? Okay. All right.
No, I think having been through a few definition exercises, which is, this one actually is giving us, you know, terrific feedback, so thank you. We'll certainly, as you take in the comments, Barbara, but then it will become a point where we actually now have to pause and take a look at the slide, and then... Yeah,
right.
So I know you're heading in that direction, so nothing to, but I know as you were saying, Margaret, that there's logical reasons as to why you'd want to do some splitting as opposed to lumping at this moment. Yeah.
Okay, with that in mind, Andrew, Robert, Jeffrey, Dennis, Q, and then we'll go back to the definition. So, Andrew.
Okay, I've been trying to listen and pull out what I think are distinguishing characteristics, and some of the problems that we're having with the slide seem to me to be sort of linguistic challenges we cause for ourselves. Some of the things like interactions and perceived burden and expectations I think are all important to come up with, into the conversation, but they are sort of downstream of the definition, and I think that's complicating things. It seems we've got a couple of points on the table, and I don't know if this is helpful, but I'll throw it out for the group. We know that it seems like there's reason to suggest that these conditions last for more than a year. They're sufficient in combination to limit life expectancy, functional status, or role. And I say that only because activities of daily living are so basic, and people with chronic disease do wonderful jobs of workarounds that they all score independent, and they come across in research like there's no problems. So lasting more than a year is sufficient in combination to limit life expectancy, requiring attention from more than one, and Margaret, I suggested more than one healthcare provider or professional. Professional providers might be a little bit too vague, but it seems to me that part of what's going on here is that there's a tension that what you have is so complex, you're immediately out of whatever specialist, primary care physician, nurse practitioner, or holistic health provider you're going to, that somebody else needs to be called in on the case, and that it involves multiple interventions that by their very nature require coordination of care. That if we're concerned that too many people will fall into the definition of who has a multiple chronic disease, then part of it is not only the cluster of what they have, but how it is being worked out. And that would seem that what you've got cannot be well handled by a single provider and necessitates coordination of care. And that may be part of what we're trying to get at in this particular definition. Just to throw that out, I don't know where to work in that all of this occurs in a specific socio-cultural context, which either makes it much harder on the patient or the provider or both, or much easier. But I think we need to separate out sort of criteria from issues which ensue for patient or provider. And I think that's some of the problems we're having. So anyway.
Good. Thank you, Andrew. Robert.
So I agree with many of the recent comments, and one of the ones I was struggling with was this idea of having guidelines for every condition, because I think that would have really limited how we define this. But I'm a bit concerned, and I'm not sure if it's in the definition or not, in terms of whether this only includes conditions that are somewhat treatable. So, for example, one of which was raised before are patients who have visual impairments. Another that comes to mind is patients that are demented or have dementia, you know, or early stages, and the influence that has on other conditions in terms of their own compliance with, you know, their treatments and so on. So I think this is something, it's not clearly stated here, but we need to consider chronic conditions that we may not actually be treating because there's nothing that can be done. So that's what I want to make sure that gets thought about.
Thank you. Jeffrey?
You asked about changes here. I wondered if somehow we can fit in prioritize in here for the provider's attention. Just real quickly, we've tried to use a number of the off-the-shelf predictive models in Medicaid. They don't work because of mental health and substance abuse isn't included. So we've actually designed our own so that we have a predictive model that can direct some of the care for the case managers and providers. When I had my VA clinic, it was, you know, I had these kind of, this was my entire clinic, because the nurses took off the single disease. But what I found, you know, even now in Medicaid is that I like this perceived burden of family and patient, because they're not necessarily always concentrated on the chronic disease. They might want, you know, how to stabilize a foster care placement, or they might want to, how do I get on vacation, you know, and still take my meds, blah, blah, blah. But the one thing that I struggle with as a provider and now as a Medicaid, you know, leader is how do you prioritize? And I'm not sure where that is. Either ongoing provider attention and prioritization or perceived burden of family, patient, and provider. And quite frankly, you know, if I'll finish up here, but if, you know, whichever provider you go to defines what the priorities are. If I've got mental health and I go to a psychiatrist, it's going to be medications. If I go to a psychologist, it's going to be mental health management. If I go to, you know, X, Y, and Z specialist, it'll be just their specialist. And there's no way that I can prioritize what do I need to start first, other than I do definitely agree that you have to look at what the patient and the family want too. So prioritization, I'd like to see that in somewhere in the definition if we could.
Great. Dennis.
I'm going to be a little bit of a nihilist and say that we have talked about a lot of really critical things for thinking about patients and taking care of patients, but they don't really relate to the measurement framework at all. And what I mean by that is that I thought that what we are trying to do is decide if you have competing things that don't mesh, then how does the practitioner make sense of them? And so none of this really gets to that. And so I'm going to propose you a really simple, one-sentence, no-bullets definition that I'd like you to put up. And there's a caveat hidden within it. So it goes like this. Two or more medical conditions that last a year or more requiring continuing medical treatment with functional severity index greater than X. That's the caveat. I'll come back. In which treatments are likely to entail conflicting interactions and trade-offs. Okay, now, then we would have to have a second round in which we develop our severity index. And that could include a lot of what we've been talking about for the last 20 minutes. But I don't think that's the definition of what we're doing with the framework. The framework is about that you're trying to take care of someone with multiple conditions and you have conflicting things to do, and how do you sort out those conflicts? And how do you develop a research agenda to evaluate that?
Okay, let me, we're going to hear from Q, and then let me give you a preview of where we'll go with that. We're going to ask you to take a break, mental, physical, whatever you need. And in 10 minutes after that, we'll come back with where we think we are and begin to work towards that. So cue your resounding comment as we leave.
It's just like multiple chronic conditions. So, there were some good comments made before. I'm just thinking out loud. Genetic syndrome, sickle cell, cystic fibrosis, these are conditions that affect multiple organs. So they often require multiple providers. I would argue that a diabetic who's blind and has an amputation is someone who satisfies this definition, even though it's just the diabetes that caused all those problems. So I think we're really trying to define complexity. Just to put it simple, I think it's just two or more chronic conditions that require complex care. But we're not used to defining things in medicine or in the biomedical model. We got to make it like some acronym like MCC and try to make it really interesting. So I would say the thing that I like in a simple definition, because I think a definition is like a vision statement for us. It's sort of like what the vision is. And I love the idea of us getting into the depths of what severity indexes are and things of that sort. I would really appreciate hearing what people's perspective are. But I think we're ultimately about complex care that affects the length and quality of life and requires continuous, I agree, not medical, clinical care and potentially multiple providers. I mean, I think there's an equation there. We're talking about from the healthcare perspective, we are healthcare centric. This group is this is a biomedically kind of oriented group. So I think you want multiple providers. There's some, and then you want continuous interface with that healthcare system, and then it affects the length and quality of life. So, and which I think captures everything else. So, that's it.
If you have a recommended short, sweet statement, we'll take that. So with that, we'll break for 10 minutes, and I appreciate all the others in queue, and we'll come back and address what we have as a definition. Thank you.
Thank you for all your thoughts and the breadth of what you brought to this definition. So we'd like to begin, and I'm going to ask Karen just to kind of remind us where we are with our mission.
So first I want to thank everyone for their many contributions to as we start to develop the definition that will guide us moving forward. And so what we're presenting here is side by side, of course, QU gave us some good guidance on how we might encapsulate, you know, capture this quite succinctly. And then we have on the other side that really starts to delineate out some of the important concepts and bullets that we would find to be true moving forward, and Cynthia will discuss that more. So I think that, you know, certainly in having a definition, and Helen, of course, you know, when there's calls for measures or when a committee is working on an endorsement type of project, it's always helpful to, you know, understand, well, does this include measures of functional status? Does this include measures of social environmental factors? You know, things that have been brought up very, I would say, smartly and thoughtfully here. So I think for the next, we said about 15 minutes, mm-hmm. we wanted to present the succinct version and the more detailed version, discuss in which way we want to go moving forward, and then we'll be able to take that back naturally. As with any process with our committees, staff will work with this, work with our chairs, you'll get to see this again, but that we would reach some general comfort as to where we've landed with some of the great feedback. So I'm going to pass it on to Cynthia. And
I guess actually we'll look at the one on the right, which is slide 26, first, which the co-chairs and Karen and all of us have been trying to work to try to capture the essence. It's not necessarily wordsmith perfectly of what people said, but if there would be, I think, potentially advantages to going with a shorter, more concise definition. But that would obviously require some more detail or more explanation in the text of the framework report. But so that the first one is two or more concurrent chronic conditions, and that this for sure includes clinical, behavioral, and social conditions that affect the length or quality of life. And we have been, when we wrote this, we're including function as part of quality of life. I mean, we could debate about what the right word to use is there. And are associated with complicated health needs and perceived burden of care for patient, family, and providers. And I think that we would propose, but are interested in the pediatricians in the group responding to it, that this, thinking about it this way, would potentially encompass the idea of something like cystic fibrosis, which may be all driven by one disease, but that there may be failure to thrive, lung conditions, and other ones, so that there really are two or more, even if there is sort of one underlying process, as Hugh mentioned, that, you know, multiple organ systems, but that there really are still multiple conditions in there. So we can circle back, and we're obviously going to circle back and see what everyone thinks of this and if there are changes that they were made. But I think that the things we took away for if we wanted either a more detailed definition or what we might have in sort of the explanatory text that we might end up referring back to, that it would be two or more concurrent chronic conditions, again, clinical, behavioral, social, that require ongoing essentially attention, and that this might be a clinical, it might be behavioral, it might be mental, it might be more sort of health or wellness focused, thinking about trying to prevention strategies. So again, not sure 100% what the right word are to put there. That does, and these are definitely ors here, influences the care of other conditions or leads to high levels of complexity or difficulty stabilizing or difficulty achieving care coordination or affects functional roles or outcomes or leads to limitations of life expectancy or leads to contraindications or, and we've inserted this word severe, which would obviously need some level of definition, but there seemed to be some debate about including interactions or limitations for patients' ability to self-manage and the patient's and family's perceived burden. So we're interested in what you think.
And to focus on, just for sake of brevity, to move ahead and target, are there things that you cannot live with?
Or that are not there that mm-hmm. you
can't must, live with. You cannot live without.
Right. There may be we may have overlooked something that you can't live without.
Yes, Joseph.
I can live with a lot of straw men, but I'm struggling with the definition and the fit to pediatrics. And I have to think more about it. What are the pediatric special needs or how this chronic conditions fit? And I go back to your introduction that you mentioned that maybe there are population-based definitions that need to be separated, and maybe we have to have a pediatric and above 21 or young adults and adults. Because if you look at the pediatric field, where our grads are moving into the adult field, whereas if you look at geriatrics, they move in a different field. So for me, how the pediatric population is transitioned to adult care, and how these definitions fit later and dictate the care for pediatrics is a big challenge to. And I don't have yet an opinion, but the fit to pediatrics seems to me problematic.
For the shorter one, or for
the shorter
both?
One.
The shorter one?
I had problems with the longer one as well. So I have a problem with the concept. That's the reason in your introduction when you said, and the priorities, do we have to have, and I think people didn't prioritize it high, population-based rather than one definition fits it all. And maybe we'll come to this back at the end.
Well, or if it's appropriate, we could work offline with our pediatric members, representatives on the committee, and come back.
Yes, it requires more sort of vetting.
Thought. Good. Good.
Thank you. I'll just say, as a pediatrician, I was actually, okay. I mean, there are a lot of terms in there, care coordination, families, you know, I'm actually, you know, the fact that social was included in there and behavioral, I don't know. I could see it kind of resonating potentially with pediatric providers. I also do think about things like, I mean, pediatrics created the whole concept of medical home, and now it's been transformed into PCMH and all this stuff. So, I mean, I like the fact that we say health needs as opposed to, you know, medical needs too. I mean, there's a lot that holistically to me resonates with potentially there. So.
Leona. I'm sorry, Leona, and then we'll move.
I beg your pardon. Do you want me to speak?
Yes, please, Leona.
I think just from the pediatrics perspective, I think that the two or more conditions that that Cynthia spoke about is, it's not intuitively obvious that this definition would include the many situations in children where a given disease has ramifications for, you know, leads to multiple diseases, but they're all part of the same disease. So it's almost like if we want to choose that, we would need an asterisk with a footnote at the bottom to sort of explain that. Otherwise, I think the first way people would look at it would be to think of two separate conditions. I think that's one important issue. I think the self-management in the case of children is usually by parents, and we would need to sort of incorporate that part. The perceived burden is also important, but kind of squishy. I'm not sure how to deal with that. And that's not really for pediatrics. That's for everybody. It's a problematic one. And I think I have to think through the various conditions that we see in children. But many of them are, for example, the results of prematurity. So there are all these multiple chronic conditions leading from it, but would that be captured in here? Where does intellectual disability fit in, which is a big issue, very common? where does something like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder fit in, which would probably be 30% of children at this point or something like that. So all those questions, I'm just in a sort of practical sense, I'm not sure how they fit in.
So it sounds like that would reinforce the offline work with the pediatric to make this clear. Michael.
I like the way the definition is put out. What I did in the break is I wrote down a series of things that maybe should be in the definition. You've listed most of them. I'd say the problem is to make sure that each one is stated correctly. I think that the two or more condition issue was one I was really considering because maybe it is too limiting to say it that way. In other words, is it just two or more conditions or medical conditions? So I put down, in a sense, two or more medical diseases, medical problems or conditions, because, again, when you have a patient with cystic fibrosis that has a very simple, or has a mild case and he's young, he may not really fit into that yet. But so the real point is, I would say, in saying maybe something like two or more conditions or medical diseases manifested by, and those would be things that would result in functional status. See, the things that I wrote down, just as the things we've been talking about, to put in this sentence are life expectancy, organ dysfunction, functional status, complexity of management, frequent adjustments in therapy, need for care coordination, need for self-management. Again, the goal is to have people that don't have a minor problem, but have maybe multiple ICD-9 codes in their list, and how to get that in the definition so that we're not measuring two different types of people.
Thank you. Caroline?
I can add other people.
Okay. Mary?
Let's see. I wanted to make a case for why multiple conditions are important, and I'm not a pediatrician, I'm an internist, so I'm really ready to be thrown off the island with this, but one of the problems that was seen in this emerging area was the fact that there was a void of information when you start putting together different illnesses, because the cardiologists who make the heart failure guideline have never even thought about the issues that the rheumatologists are concerned with. And in contrast, when an adult has sickle cell disease, without a doubt, they have manifestations in multiple organ systems, but there is a highly competent set of colleagues in the hematology oncology departments who are making practice guidelines for the care of patients with sickle cell, simple and complex sickle cell. So they're, so in a way, I don't see the aching need for NQF to step into a space where there are already highly competent, maybe they're partialists, but whatever, they're people who've devoted their life to this particular illness, maybe it's cystic fibrosis, maybe it's sickle cell, that has multiple organ manifestations. And they already understand the science. They already understand the clinical valleys and peaks. And so for NQF to say it needs to insert itself, I'm not saying that there's not coordination complexity because of the multiple specialists that are involved, but it's just not exactly the same as the space where the different groups of people need to come together in a way that only NQF can do, because heretofore there have been siloed ways of imagining individual conditions or behavioral or social things, and there has not been a space for a collaborative way of looking at
those overlapping things. So that is why I would suggest that to some degree this group, you know, because of the impossibility of boiling the ocean, right, try to limit itself just a wee bit, and to say that the space where the need is the greatest is in the area where there are entities, maybe their existing guidelines, you know, as an example of low-hanging fruit, or but in any case where they are multiple different conditions.
Margaret.
I love it. I think it's clear, it's concise, it meets the idea that it's like a mission statement. We want it to be short, clear, and fairly universally recognized as a definition of the concept.
The short or the longer or both?
The shorter one.
Short.
The two or more chronic conditions. I think the group during the break nailed the many concepts that we thought were important to define this phenomenon. And I think that that short definition does capture in a concise, succinct way what we're talking about and would serve as an opening definition. And since the definition is not the only piece of the document we're preparing, the opportunity to expand all of these and define further all of these concepts in this definition would exist. But as a beginning definition, I don't think we want to play with it too much. I think it's perfect.
Barbara?
I agree. I like it too. I just want to react or comment a little bit to Mary's thoughts. I'm not sure what we're going to wind up doing with this. I mean, I have to sit down and think, okay, so if you meet this definition, which has got squishy bits in it, like what's complicated, et cetera. But nevertheless, let's say you meet this definition, then what do we do with it? We say there are certain metrics, right, that are going to apply to whoever this population is. And I want to make sure that it applies to the partialists who are making their quality measures for their disease of interest, because what bugs me is that it does get so siloed and it gets so sometimes intense. They see the world with that disease. And I think it's very important for them to also have their heels to the fire in terms of thinking of the entire patient and not their disease. So I think it will be relevant for their consideration, and I want to make sure that if we say two or more, they don't exclude themselves because they're talking about sickle cell and they say it's only one disease, because we have to make it clear that complex patients must have metrics that are beyond the specific disease of interest.
Kelly.
I mentioned earlier in the conversation that Cynthia and I had about some of the methodologic issues around the use of measures, the issue of the individual condition complexity is really important as you start thinking about measure construction, exclusions, exceptions, et cetera. So I'm not sure. I think this definition works, but I think it's really important as you think about the broader framework. There has to be some explication of when, in fact, two or more conditions is too narrow. And, in fact, a patient with really end-stage Alzheimer's doesn't need to have other conditions. To have metrics need to be shifted and changed to make them work for that patient.
I mean, I like the shorter one. I think conditions kind of, it doesn't say chronic diseases, so it sort of covers the whole broad, like a syndrome of like the multiple organs. One thing that I thought was, I'm not as, I mean, wordsmithing a little, but complicated doesn't, like complex to me, I mean, thinks is more kind of resonant. I mean, you know, it's on your coding complex. You know, I think it will resonate more with the clinical community potentially than complicated. One thing that's sort of missing that I would love to have in the short definition is team-based. Something about the need to have, you know, a team that's working together on taking care of it. And that isn't necessarily excluding, you know, that isn't necessarily has to include, you know, everyone. It could be the nurses, the case managers, the care coordinators. It doesn't have to be another specialist or another, you know. One of the things that was very important that I heard from Barbara after I talked about multiple providers, we don't want to create a definition that incentivizes people to do more referrals.
Okay. Gail.
Yeah, when you say team-based, I don't know if we can get that in. I mean, that might be just too complicated. But what is important, and maybe that's it's understood somewhere, and we talked about this, with health IT and the connection, if you do have multiple providers, that they should be connected through EHR, PHR, or somehow passing information back and forth, rather than just have it be, you know, them.
Make it work. And Christina?
I think you already alluded to it, but I really like, on the left-hand side, functional roles, and I do see that as quite different than quality of life, which I think sometimes can be more nebulous and squishy, and I think functional roles is very concrete, and people can get that.
Andrew?
I really like both of these for a lot of reasons. Though, just a little suggestion on number three, that it would affect functional abilities, roles, and outcomes. I think the abilities and roles need to be separated there. And then I guess, just to state a fear again, if we get too pathological in how we understand conditions, I think we raise, and too pathology-oriented, we really raise the opportunity for confusion. I think many of us healthcare providers understand conditions to include impairments and activity limitations. So to me, end-stage Alzheimer's disease is never one disease. Neither is cystic fibrosis one disease, at least coming from a professional perspective. I wouldn't even begin to think of it as that. So, and if that's not clear, and that this is a bit of a revelation to me that other perspectives might, in fact, treat it that way. So if that's the case, then we do need to tease that out. Conditions seem to me to cover pathologies, impairments, activities, and role limitations very, very clearly as conditions.
Jeff?
I like this. Well, I think conditions with clinical, behavioral, and social, to me, works. And just wordsmithing, I don't know from the pediatric, but instead of life expectancy, just limitations of life, parentheses, adult and child. I don't know if that resonates with the pediatric, but, I mean, the pediatrics aren't necessarily thinking of life expectancy, per se. I mean, that's more of a geriatrics or an internal medicine sort of terminology. So I don't know if that wordsmithing worked for the peds, but to me, that it would work for Medicaid.
Fiona?
I think life expectancy is important, and a lot of the conditions for pediatrics do affect life expectancy, even if it's not during the ages 0 to 15, but it affects life expectancy. So I think, in principle, it's important to include. And I think that, like, it seems to me there's a fundamental tension that we have to resolve between what Mary articulated very, very clearly and very well, you know, about important conditions that have multiple manifestations or organs affected, which in turn require many specialists, and whether those are considered one disease or multiple, one condition or multiple conditions. Or by the same token, if a condition has depression as a result of having the condition, does that make it one condition or two conditions? So it just seems to me that that's a sort of a fundamental tension. I believe that in pediatrics, we would probably be taking a very small sliver of children we consider to have chronic illnesses if we go with the idea that, you know, that sickle cell disease or cystic fibrosis is one, doesn't reach this level of complexity. We would just be, we have to be very cognizant that we would be kind of really limiting the number of children we're talking about within that definition. But I understand your question about feasibility of what can be addressed. So that's why I feel this is a tension we need to resolve.
Okay. I can't thank you enough, and I'm going to ask for those who would like to volunteer for the pediatric effort to let Karen know, so we include all those who would like. And I don't know if it's a threat or solace that this is not the last time you will likely see this definition. But we appreciate it, and we'll move ahead. Thank you. Complicated to complex.
Right, we've been taking notes to edit for this. Yeah. When you have the two sides up side by side, I know it's difficult. So I've kept a running list of the proper edits.
So also, how can we clarify how the two definitions fit together? For example, the short one would sort of be the overall definition, and then the longer one would be sort of the modifiers, and the modifiers could get wordsmithed. Is that how you were thinking?
It's like
people's understanding is, yeah.
It's like an executive summary and then the body of the paper. So the definition might be a couple of pages to define all these constructs, but there's your executive summary of what we plan to expand. Because I think as the discussion has gone around, we need to define the difference between a condition and a diagnosis. We need to talk about what is a complex health need. What do we mean by length of life and quality of life? All those concepts have to be described in more detail. No, I don't see the second document. I think are all the content, the constructs that went into the more concise document.
All right.
Now we're shifting gears. Okay. I think we know what we did. Yes, now we're something entirely different. Well, this is what I think of as more of the fun part. Because this is for us to think about and chew on, and very interesting sort of high-level theoretical information. I don't know that we actually have a decision point to make on this. This will be something that we'll be talking about, that we're introducing. Who knows? We may decide. But... okay, so we're going to be talking about developing a conceptual model for multiple chronic conditions. And I think Karen Adams and Aaron and Bruce are going to help with this, so should I just let you guys start?
Sure, thank you. Great. And I'm just going to take a few moments of stage setting because I can't wait to dive into the model that our Hopkins team has been thinking about, and it's a little bit more exciting than them. But you see here, and we talked a bit about this certainly on our webinar, this is the NQF endorsed patient-focused episode of care model. And when we think about all the complexity that we've talked about today, you know how difficult it is to try to capture something in a simple diagram. But and also having worked with our pediatric community too, how do you reflect that across a lifespan or a life course? But allow me to say that, you know, several years ago, perhaps 6 years ago, the NQF worked with several distinguished people as yourself, and we started to develop a measurement framework for evaluating efficiency. We actually went through a similar exercise that we did now on how you define efficiency, and I will say that we didn't quite finish it as quickly or as efficiently. But, you know, a part of this was, you know, what was happening in the field, and certainly this belief that efficiency meant quality and cost, that costs were part of the equation. And those of us who certainly were involved with the early IOM work know that that was one of the six aims. So as you look at this generic episode of care, I think there's some important tenets to take away that we could build on, but certainly the complexity we talked about today warrants us taking this further. And one is that you see that large bubble, population at risk, very important. Symbolically, it's larger because the committee felt quite strongly that we need to be upstream. We have to think about primary prevention and the role of social determinants, behavioral, all the things that we've talked about today. But then as you move into evaluation and management, and those tails there are intentional to show this overlap, what are some of the things you want to consider? Certainly around care coordination, patient and family engagement, safety, efficiency, and then the follow-up care. Now, this was developed as a measurement framework, and at that time, and even I would say now, you know, the measures or the frames that we had available to us were, you know, 30-day readmissions, 30-day mortality, et cetera. But I think the important thing is that when you were looking at what would be the outcomes of this measurement framework, it was very much around outcomes, patient outcomes, including functional status, health-related quality of life, certainly mortality and morbidity, processes of care, but more importantly, processes of care that were more proximal to outcomes or had a strong evidence base that were linked to outcomes, and cost of care. So this was what was being attempted to show that show this through the patient and family lens, going across time, across settings, and focusing on outcomes, both quality and cost. So I'll go to the next slide. Knowing that, and I think I've brought out some of the strengths, we knew there were some weaknesses. We felt some of the strengths, or at least as it's been used in the field. We've adapted this to several conditions, AMI, low back pain, substance abuse, illness, cancer, breast, and colorectal. But, of course, every time we did this, we were saying, you know, complex patients, multiple chronic conditions, how can we build on this? But we did feel it had a patient orientation, that it was looking through the patient lens as the unit of analysis, if we may speak. It was directed at value, including quality, cost, and, importantly, patient preferences. It did emphasize care coordination and the transitions and handoffs. You know, the attempt, of course, of all of this, and particularly as we look at our new care delivery models, is around shared accountability. And I know, Caroline, that's something as we look to these new models. But, you know, as you start to look at care, and if we have this ideal state of measures that travel across settings and things like that, that would be ideal. Addresses shared decision-making. We worked with Jim Weinstein, Dartmouth, and really looking at the patient and that formal process and how the patient is part of it, not just the receiving end of things. And, of course, for us, payment reform was a topic that was quite heavily on the table because this was prior to health reform, and so it was something that, and this was an efficiency measurement framework, so that was there. So if we go to the limitations, which, of course, many of which I hope that the work that we're doing is going to address, you know, when we talk about overuse, and this had come up in some of the homework, you know, how do you address appropriateness of care? And how do you, on the flip side, if you look at overuse, there's always underuse, and how do you address that? Of course, the issue of risk adjustment, I know we're going to spend quite a bit of time on methodological issues. We'll tease some of that up today. It's already coming out of our definition discussion, and we do have subsequent webinar and follow-on meetings. But, you know, the risk adjustment and particularly unintended consequences of that were quite important. But, you know, a major thing was how do you sort out patients with multiple chronic conditions. And then one thing that was raised, too, is that particularly if you're trying to do QI, this ability also to be able to, within your own organization, use this as a tool. And so with that, I'll ask for the next slide. And this was our committee's first attempt. It's looking more complex and complicated, isn't it? But many of you know Mary Naylor and many others who contributed to this work. But, you know, this is where we started to think about different trajectories. So if we started, for example, if it was an AMI, you know, certainly it could be a quote-unquote relatively healthy adult, but now has obviously CAD, or, you know, it could be someone with congestive heart failure who this is yet another assault. And there would be different trajectories, and certainly an important thing that came out of here was the introduction of palliative care more upstream. But, you know, as we were starting to develop this and play this out for the various conditions and then overlaying it with the important priorities, which I'm pleased to share are now part of the national quality strategy that the National Priorities Partnership had put forth around patient and family centeredness and the care coordination and safety and affordability across, you know, how do you weave this in? So this was a beginning attempt as we were evolving this model, and it's very hard to put something that's two-dimensional, or as we often say, it feels like a Rubik's Cube sometimes. You know, how do you move forward with that? So we've Fortunately, we have not only this committee, but our Hopkins team, who has been giving some thinking around a conceptual model. We find that those are all often helpful, particularly when we try to communicate this, but also it stimulates, you know, issues around methodological concerns, because this is a measurement type of framework. And so I think then that would be the last of my slides, and then I'm going to turn it over to the Hopkins team, and I know they have some things to tee up. I can certainly entertain any questions you have about this, but I just thought it was helpful for you to understand the evolution of whence we've come.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Erin Giovanetti. I'm a health services researcher working with the Hopkins team, and I'm going to present to you a conceptual model that we've developed, but first I'm going to let my speaker introduce himself again.
Hi, Bruce Leff, geriatrician and health services researcher at Hopkins.
So I'm actually going to ask if you can go back one slide, because before you look at our model, I want to just make some things very clear. Obviously, this is a very complex topic that's going to have a lot of moving parts, and when we were trying to come up with a conceptual model, there are going to be certain domains that overlap, certain domains that may not be explicitly included on this model. And so really we're just trying to right now come up with a basic idea. And the one thing I want to make really clear is that this model is a picture to guide the development of the final framework for performance measurement for people with MCCs. This is not a final framework. So I'm going to say that one more time just so that everyone understands. This is a conceptual model to guide the development of a final framework for measurement. This is not a measurement framework. Okay.
Can I ask a quick question? Where's tertiary prevention? Because part of me thinks that's the end. Is it even
there?
We're
not doing this model.
I know, but I'm just on this model. I always thought someone had a heart attack, that's tertiary prevention. Secondary and tertiary, I would say. Is there any tertiary?
There was tertiary in this model. Sorry, it's hard to put everything, I guess. And Helen, you can speak to this too, because even people were saying the secondary prevention also goes back up into the first bottle once bubble once you, but it was certainly under consideration. It was part of the model.
Okay, so we'll move on now to the next slide. Okay, so I'm going to walk you through this model. First, I'm going to describe it, and then I'm going to describe how we think that this could work in action. So this all centers around a patient and their family, and this patient may have multiple conditions or diseases which vary in magnitude and vary in the degrees in which they overlap. So that's represented by the very center of the circle. We see a patient, and they've got these bubbles of conditions that are all different sizes that have different amounts of overlap. And really what we're concerned about and what this whole, all of our measurements should be about is the patient and family goals and preferences for care. And we wanted to keep that at the very center of the model. And this includes palliation at all stages of care, not just at end of life. So this patient, the patient family's goals and preferences for care exist within these rotating wheels. And the first wheel is that there's a rotating sites of care. Care can be provided in the primary care, specialty care, hospital, community, home, or nursing home. And this list is not meant to be exhaustive of all the sites of care, but just to give you some examples of places where people receive care. These sites of care, at any one of these sites of care, a patient may be receiving multiple types of care. And so we've listed here some examples including screening, prevention, diagnosis, treatment and management, acute exacerbation, rehabilitation, and palliation. A patient may be receiving more than one types of care at any given time. So, for example, you may be dealing with an acute exacerbation in the hospital, a congestive heart failure, but also at the same time needing to do treatment and management ongoing of someone's diabetes and lung cancer. And once again, we're stressing the point that palliation may be occurring at multiple stages of care, not just at end of life. So these types of care, so for any given site and type of care, we have proposed multiple domains of measurement. So our domains that we propose here include the three which were originally part of the patient episodes of care framework, which include cost and resource use, which is both the amount of money and the amount of services used, processes of care, which measure which include measures of overuse, underuse, or misuse, but also can include non-disease specific measures such as medicine reconciliation. And we've also, pulling from the patient episodes model, the patient, and we've added and family level outcomes because we think in this population it's very important that we explicitly include the family. And this encompasses a whole range of different outcomes that are both patient reported and non-patient reported. So just some examples of things we've come up with are health outcomes, health-related quality of life, patient and family centeredness, goal attainment, shared decision-making, engagement, satisfaction, access to care, self-management, education, burden for both the family and the patient. So you can see this is a big, big group of different outcomes. Also, we've added three additional domains of measurement. One is safety, which we all realize is very important, particularly for this group. And in safety, we're also including here some of the unintended consequences that occur from conflicting treatments and therapies. We've also included now a whole domain of communication, care coordination, and integration. These measures look at coordination and communication between physicians, specialists, sites of care, and also including integration of the whole care plan so that there's an understanding amongst all of the people treating the patient of what the patient and family's goals and preferences are, what their priorities are. And then finally, we've added a measure of structure, which structure measures would examine the presence of structural elements aimed at improving patient care and coordination, such as electronic health records or the presence of a self-management support group. So these three wheels are going to be moving a long time, and you're obviously going to have to, in any measurement, pick a time period over which to assess. And we can define that time period as an episode, but we are all recognizing that, especially for people with multiple chronic conditions, that the beginning and end of an episode may be more difficult to define. And so as we think about this, for some people, an episode may be 1 year of care, as opposed to a clinically defined beginning and end to an episode. Okay, so now I'm going to show you how this would work in action. So as you can see, next slide. Okay, so back one slide. Mm-hmm. Oh, fantastic. Thank you. So as you can see, these three wheels move independently, and they can go forward and backwards based off of, so hopefully you can see at the bottom, time is moving as we have this going through. And one example of how this could be used is that we could say at this point in time, we're going to be looking at a patient and family outcome, level outcome when we're doing palliation in the home setting. So, and at another given point in time, we could be looking at a process of care measure such as care planning with a new diagnosis of advanced cancer in oncology. Now, the advantage of this model is that we can also overlay that at the same time that we're looking at that measure, we may also want to be looking at communication, care coordination, and integration between specialty care and primary care of that care planning and new diagnosis. So multiple things can be measured at the same time. And this, you know, we're limited here in the two-dimensionality of the model, and, you know, we're not always going to see the correct overlap, but I think that we're hoping that this model, well, first makes conceptual sense, and we'd be interested in feedback on well, whether or not it makes sense to you. And then second, if there are domains that you think are not included on here that should be included. And then finally, if there are domains that you think there's too much overlap between and we should lump together. So with that, I will turn it over to discussion, unless, Bruce, you have anything to add.
I would only add that it's I was wondering. No, I would only add that it's always great to work with Erin because she lays things out so beautifully. But I think as we're thinking about this notion of lumping and splitting is just to keep it in mind, because we could make this, if we start to split, this could become a bit chaotic with too many things on these wheels. If you start to lump too much, then, you know, it might appear to be a bit too simplistic. And we operated with that tension in mind. I'm sure we did not nail it completely, but just to let you know that if you don't see a label or concept that is near and dear to your heart, that don't take it personally. We were just trying to be discreet in the way that we presented the model. And I'll leave it there unless Cynthia has anything to add.
Hey, I think that one thing that we might just add, that we've talked a lot about, is that I think people probably have a sense of what communication and care coordination are, but that for people with multiple chronic conditions, actually arriving at a plan that is tried to integrate across all of people's conditions is something that we don't necessarily have the evidence base to do yet in many circumstances, but it's definitely, I think, one of the goals. So that's what we mean by integration here.
Can I write a little bit on the comment?
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead.
Thank you. So as I'm listening to this, and again, I don't have the advantage of visuals, so I apologize for anything that's imprecise. But the one comment that's been implicit, and an explicit as well, is the patient's preference, family preference. And the one thing which I really wonder about repeatedly is who is teaching the patient? What are the patient's expectations based upon? As far as my view of the clinical medicine is concerned, people have a vested interest in some of the things they recommend. The surgeon may see a surgical solution. The interventional cardiologist may see a benefit from their point of view. And they potentially can bias the patient in terms of what the expectations may be, and shape the expectations in a way that may not be consistent with the others involved. So I'm concerned who is in charge of that. And again, the other point that I'd just like to make is that the issue of congestive heart failure has come up at least a half a dozen times already. Congestive heart failure is often born out of the treatment of other physicians. The dose of steroids, the antibiotics, the intravenous fluid define congestive heart failure. But then suddenly the cardiologist is involved, making a decision from his or her perspective, and suddenly we'll start raising other aspects of cardiovascular disease management. They will supersede all the other issues on the table, but the fact is that disease, that condition, grew out of the management of other conditions. So I just know that we refer to complexity, but explicitly in regard to some of the cardiovascular issues, I think they're all congestive failure particularly, as a result of other management issues.
Well, Dan, how would you, that comment's important, but how would you put that comment in the context of what we're talking about in terms of this framework? Where do you think it goes?
Well, again, I know it's been added back and forth and with some very compelling arguments, but I still feel that the notion of treatment having an impact on chronic diseases, I believe is, I would think it's a shame if it's off the table. I think treatment is incredibly relevant.
And to me, the treatment goes a little bit more back to the episode framework, and that's one of the questions that I have, is how we sort of integrate this conceptual model with the episode model. Because I think the episode, I have issues with the episode model. I don't know if we're going to get to that today, but I think there might be refinements of that particular model for the multiple complicated, for the MCC patient that might take into account what you're talking about. For example, frequent adjustment of therapy. Someone talked about frequent adjustment of therapy or interacting therapies, and that may be better captured through the episode model than here. I don't know. What do you think, Erin and Bruce?
When I heard the comments over the phone, I thought some of that notion of, you know, who's driving the preferences, I think that that could come in the context of communication and integration. You know, if the patient has, let's pick a new diagnosis, newly diagnosed prostate cancer, and I think there's actually a fair bit of evidence in the literature to suggest that the treatment that you undergo may actually be a consequence of the patterns of specialists or non-specialists that you see. And I think in some ways is guided by patient preferences for certain kinds of treatments. But that final treatment is in some ways an exercise in integration and communication and the like. So, I think it's a two-dimensional figure. The preferences, we want to have close to the patient, but, you know, these circles really are, there are lots of pinging back and forth across the circles, and I think that might be one place where that comes through, if I understood the comments correctly.
Okay, who's, Barbara?
So I think it's quite elegant. This, I love the way they all move and have different dimensions that it follows. Couple things. One is that we have to think about the context in which this will be used. And I worry a lot about respondent burden here, because most of the dimensions we're talking about here are not blood pressure that I can just pick out of my EMR and give to you. I worry that if we do a lot of this, we're going to really promote cherry picking. I don't want to deal with all those measures unless you incentivize me to say, yeah, I really want to take these people on because I have to collect all this data and deal with all this stuff. But, you know, I get incentivized. The cost, unfortunately, is creeping back into my head about this. The other thing that's interesting is this who's in charge here. As a general internist, I often feel like everybody goes, well, they're responsible for everything that goes on. In a way, I would like to feel like I am useful because often when I have a longitudinal relationship with a patient and somebody comes in with a specific recommendation from a urologist to do such and such, it's my role to put it in context. And how you capture that, I have no idea. But I'm often trying to offer a balanced view of what the recommendations of specialists are. I mean, they'll come in with their shtick, and then my job is to try. And I hate to have them get off the hook all the time. That's what really annoys me. I mean, I'm always this. I mean, I'm sure Dennis is the same way. It's a court of last resort. So. I want to keep this practicality and respondent burden theme present, although I believe that all of these are important dimensions of care. And I would suggest we prioritize things that are really important and feasible at the same time.
Okay, Margaret?
I, too, like the model very much as a first draft. I think it's very cleverly put together, and the way the wheels interact and you can pull out a section resonates a whole lot. I'd like to suggest two additions to types of care, and one is screening. The patient with Okay, then I only have one suggestion. As you correctly identified, palliation is not end-of-life care. But end-of-life care is missing from the wheel.
Okay. Jeffrey, I think you're in.
I too like this. I especially like the sites of care. We're looking at, you know, where the care is given, and we find that that is a huge driver of some of our chronic care condition outliers. For example, one prescriber in our state was actually 2% of our entire pharmacy budget. We have about 35 prescribers that represent, you know, very aberrant pain management, which gets at about 1,500 of our extremely, you know, high-dose narcotics. So I like this idea of site of care, and I'd like to hear more about how you're looking at this. One addition, and I know it's embedded in treatment and management, but I'd like to put drugs in there or Rx. I mean, just we know that in chronic care, you know, diabetes, asthmatic, schizophrenia, 20% to 40% aren't taking their meds on a regular basis, and it, because it's kind of embedded in treatment therapy. But I mean, it, to me, because pharmacy is a real time information service. I mean, I'm 95% complete in 2 weeks. I know if people aren't picking their meds up. If they don't pick their meds up, they go to the hospital, they go to the ER, they get admitted to mental health hospital. So I know it's embedded in treatment and management, but I'd really like to see drugs pulled out as a separate category. And, again, I want to push medication adherence or medication possession ratios. It's, for chronic care conditions, you know, it's medications is probably paramount. And they aren't taking them. And that's, to me, a very nice marker.
Robert?
I like this model as well, and I have a question, and maybe I'm jumping a bit ahead. In terms of measurement, is this proposing new measurement, or is it relying on measurement that already exists? Because in many of these areas, there already are outcome measures, process measures, and so on. So I was thinking when you gave the example with home, you know, we have an elaborate measurement system that already exists. So are we talking about more measures, burden, or are we talking about using the current measures that exist but looking at this population differently and having different expectations with performance? So I guess that's – I don't know if you're going to answer that question today, but it is something I think we have to think about.
So, Bob, one thing, you know, certainly going through this exercise, we certainly want to build on existing measures that we have now, because what we want to have – speaking to the practicality, as Barbara has shared earlier, and is that, you know, we want to have something we can do now. So, but then we want to also be able to signal to the field, to the measure developers, to NQF as things come through the endorsement project, where are the gap areas for measurement? And we also know that many of the domains and areas that Aaron spoke to, we do have measure gaps in, although certainly some of the NQF work coming up around care coordination and population health, et cetera, will start addressing some of those. But I do think that part of this work will certainly elucidate where those measure gaps are, and that would be certainly something we would want to incorporate in our report.
But I also want to comment that I think it's not only the measurement gaps, but it may be the way we look at performance on currently existing measures. So I think that has to be considered.
Okay, I think
It's funny. I was looking at this like it was – it's very pleasing. It's kind of like a pregnancy wheel, and then I was thinking it's kind of like a rock garden, Japanese rock garden with the rocks in the middle and then a nice rake that kind of makes the three circles. But but I was then reflecting, I mean, I like it. It's kind of, I've never seen a model that kind of has that wheel approach, so there's something pleasing about it. But then I'm also thinking, if we think of the definition as, I think of it as like a mission statement, and this is kind of the vision picture that is supposed to grab people and people can resonate with, is it potentially a little too complex? I'm just suggesting that, because you want that. What I liked about the 2D framework before, and I know time is here, but, you know, there's all these debates, you know, we just changed the food pyramid to a plate, you know. What should the shape be? Should it be a triangle? Should it be a square? Should it be a circle? I mean, circles are good. I like circles. So, but then what's the mission? The mission is to get people to identify, show that the people who are complex, like if you've ever seen a TED talk on Hans Rosling, he talks about how he presents data. It's fascinating how you basically see these bubbles that represent the world, and the bubbles are getting bigger. And it's a wonderful way that data is presented and a vision of where we're going as a country in terms of, or as a world in terms of data. And the challenge is there. And part of me is like, shouldn't this be showing that we got too many people who are, we got this population, this bubble that's growing, that's becoming more and more complex, and we're in big trouble as a country. So shouldn't there be some way in which that we're showing that story? I mean, and I don't know what that is, and I think of an X and Y axis. I mean, there's ways in which you could, I like the time paradigm, because then it makes people think, oh, that's where we need to intervene. We need to prevent those people from getting to that. And then I think about complexity being the x-axis. So I'm just presenting it like there are other ways to frame things that could potentially be more simple. you know, but like, and whether or not we're emphasizing enough prevention, for example, because it's one piece there, but it's not, yeah, and I think that's important. So anyway, and self-management, we're talking about preferences, but patients are ultimately, they spend more time with themselves than they do in any of these clinical care settings, and we're kind of making them all equal. And I feel like, you know, I'm glad they're at the center and, like, looking like a bunch of rocks, but, you know, I think that, you know, I worry about that we're focusing on the conditions. Like, I almost feel like a person should be in the middle instead of, like, the four conditions. So I'm just raising some questions.
Well, I guess we're, this is for us all to think about it, but maybe you can come up with a diagram or something. Anyway, let's see, who do I have next? Andrew, I think, or next in the queue.
I think there's a lot to like about this diagram, but it raises some issues for me. One is at the center, I presume that patient family goals and preferences is also spinning?
Yes.
Okay. Because I think this is really more like a spiral than and where you are at any, and in fact, there may be interconnected spirals. The concern that I have is how this picks up for change of patient's definition of the situation of their illness over time. We tend to be using examples like cancer and things that move to end of life. And I'm concerned about things like early stage MS or mid-stage rheumatoid arthritis where you still have many, many, many years. And your experience of the chronic illness is going to change your notion of what's a good outcome, even what's a good day with my disease. And I don't know how that gets picked up here. It causes huge research problems. But I think as a clinician, it causes other kinds of problems as well, and why every patient with MS is not the same patient with MS. And even the patient I saw last year is maybe not the same patient this year. And it's not just about organs and pathology. It's really about how they perceive the situation. Similarly, what I don't see here is provider definition of the situation. Hopefully, I'm changing, I'm growing, I'm learning. The last patient teaches me for the next patient. There have been things that I've read, things that I've responded to, treatments that are new and exciting and useless, and old treatments that get rediscovered because they were abandoned too soon or they were used indiscriminately. So we're not really accounting for that sort of patient-provider interaction, because as soon as we get to performance measurement, all this stuff is really interesting, but what we're really talking about here is provider performance. Okay, we're not talking about patient performance, societal performance. We're talking about what providers do anytime they see a patient. And so I think it gets a little grandiose when it comes right down to we're not merely measuring anything else but what clinicians do. And I think that part of that becomes very critical is how does the patient define their situation, their needs, their expectations, and how does the provider either confirm or reinforce those expectations or work against them. And that's not necessarily captured here. I guess the concern that I have is if there is this seems to me to be a perfect wheel. I can imagine this. I think it would make a great little object, you know, where you could dial up, you know, any measure that would meet, this is a categorization of any measure that you could ever possibly think of, and we could add a few more things to put in any circle, and you can make, and go, oh, okay, I have a measure, and it's this, and work right through. I don't see necessarily how this informs me about what measures ought to exist. Maybe it does. I may not be getting it. It seems best at categorization rather than pointing to something. And I think that's the reason why it doesn't do that for me is because it doesn't get at what is the essential nature of the patient-provider interaction. It tells me things around that, but not really what clinicians are doing. And I don't know how clinicians would find this helpful. And if this doesn't solve clinician problems, then we definitely have increased provider burden. Experience, I think, suggests that when we come up with a measure that actually makes my job easier or makes my care more insightful, it's a great measure. I want to use it clinically. But if it's just one more damn piece of paper I got to fill out or one more thing I got to check off in order to be eligible for a bonus, yeah, I'm doing it, but I'm not really enjoying it, and it's not contributing care. So it would be helpful for me to hear how this unlocks clinical processes for the clinician and for the patient.
So I think that there are multiple things that that come to mind when you were talking. First, that we did not, once again, I'm going to go back to the intent of the model was not to inform how clinicians should treat multiple conditions. It was to inform how we may want to think about measuring performance. And performance, I don't necessarily see as solely what did the clinician do. That I believe that there's more to it than just what the clinician did. And for me, my particular area of research is around the patient and family level outcomes. And in that, I include a lot more in terms of what is the patient's perspective on their care, whether or not they're having a good day or not, quality of life, those sorts of things that perhaps when you say performance, we're judging a clinician if they did the right thing or the wrong thing, but really I see it more as measurements from which we can learn from. So to get back to your point about whether or not this is going to, I don't think that this necessarily points the future for what measurement should be. I think that's why this is a guide to develop that framework, which I see as the task of this committee, is to develop that framework of what measurement should be. This is more a way to think about the way that measurement currently is, perhaps point out some areas where we don't have very good measures, and I think that one could make the point that we don't have very good measures around a lot of patient and family level outcomes that are standardly collected, having to do with feasibility issues. So I guess I'm going to leave it at that, is that this is just to really start the thinking, and I think that's a good point that you make about trying to point the direction of where measurement should go.
Can I just add to that, Carolyn?
So,
I thought your points were terrific, and they were very thought-provoking, and I would just say that, again, in a two-dimensional figure, sometimes hard to capture everything, but I would think, you know, coming back to this notion of who's defining which conditions are important, I would think that, you know, the size of those rocks in the middle are growing and shrinking, probably on the basis of a patient's perception of what's going on, informed by their world, but including their interactions with their provider. So I think that can be captured there as well. The other thing, when I think of current measurement, you know, classic things like HEDIS, PQRI, you know, and if you were to sort of diagram those measures on this figure, I think you would get very constrained lines. There would be very, you know, second grade line segments. You know, there would not be complicated figures. And I think one of the things that, you know, if we think of the full potential of this sort of representation is the notion that when you start drawing more complex figures, I think it will start to make you guys think, as you develop the framework, you know, we really need to capture these multiple dimensions simultaneously across sites, not just a single site measure, across, you know, modalities of treatment and across domains that, you know, this was meant to be more of a thought-provoking kind of thing to put you in the mood to develop the framework. But I thought your points were just fantastic, really, and we can really try and figure that out a bit more.
Okay.
Where you fit in terms of the geriatrician. I mean, I thought that comment about the
everything's so even there. You're the same as a nursing home in this thing.
Right.
And I wonder how you...
So these few slides, believe me, were the process of a lot of whiteboards that got put up and erased, lots of different shapes. We tried DNA. I mean, we tried a lot of things. You know, recombining and all sorts of stuff. You know, we had some good times, and we should have had a few more beers along the way, probably. But what I would say is that, you know, folks with multiple chronic conditions, and you all know this, things get weighted in very different ways. Things change over minutes, days, or years. And the notion that we could say which is going to be more important for any one individual at any precise moment in time, I think would have been foolhardy. So I think the notion of understanding that, you know, this could look much more like a homunculus as opposed to a circle, and maybe that might be one way to start to think about it, and that really hadn't occurred to me until this moment, might be a way to start to, because this, you know, this could end up being more of a topographic map as opposed to a circle. You know, things can rise and fall and some kind of summation or, I'm just really trying to, I mean, Aaron taught us things about PowerPoint.
I just want to know
what
the limbic area looks like, that's all.
Right. But, you know, we're going to have to budget for a real PowerPoint, professional on
that.
Photoshop.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that was implicit in our thinking, for sure. But we just could not pull that off in two dimension.
Okay, so many of our other questions have been waiting patiently. Dr. Farber, you're next.
I just wanted to say that I felt in the graph. Now, I just want to say one thing, that any comment I make, I'm beginning to realize that after I hear two or three people talk, I've completely discounted what I said. So it could change very quickly. But it just seemed that prevention and screening were much had too much of a place in this. Once you get into chronic diseases, I've always kind of felt that screening and prevention become smaller and smaller because you're overwhelmed with the management of the serious problems. Also, maybe I missed it, but maybe palliation needs to be there amongst, or palliative care, which isn't the same as hospice. In other words, hospice, to me, when you get in hospice, now you've already given up on certain things, but technically, but palliation is always, you know, can be something more end state, you know, a later on in management where, you know, acute care is not working as well. And so that was my only comment, that prevention and for discussion, whether prevention and screening were given too high of a status.
Okay, I think Dennis was next.
The spinning wheels make my head spin. I keep coming back and look at the title, Conception Model to Guide the Development of a Framework. And so I think I may be understanding it better as we've talked, that by dialing the different wheels against each other, that simply elucidates the considerations that we need to think about. It doesn't really tell us how to do it. It just says, what are some of the interactions? So you know, you could also do this by having the columns with all of the arrows connecting everything, and this is just a different representation of that. So I think I'm a little better with that. And then having said that, you know what? It's not helping me. It's just not helping me because I'm not sure how I can get any farther in trying to do performance measures on multiple interacting variables in one spike of time, and we haven't talked about episodes. So it elucidates the complexity. It doesn't get me closer to the goal. Now, having said that, I am not sure how we can do that if we don't really have coordinated care. So if we have disjointed, uncoordinated, typical today's U.S. healthcare, where everyone sort of does their own thing and generates widgets and gets paid and no one's in charge, I don't know how we're going to do this.
Okay, Leona?
So I think this is a very elegant way of transmitting complex ideas and putting many ideas in one framework. So I like that. A couple of kind of questions or issues that I have is one with regard to children. We should be aware of the developmental issues, so that we have babies with chronic conditions who become adolescents with chronic conditions, and the world changes for them, and we have to bear that in mind. I think in the same way, it may be implicit in what you have in terms of community, but for many children, school becomes an important issue, and we should kind of explicitly recognize that. But then, you know, stepping back from the pediatric aspect, my big question is I think what other people have kind of alluded to, which is how would this really be used as we move forward? I don't exactly get that, and I don't know if it's being used for developing measures for individual healthcare providers, for systems of healthcare, because there seem to be issues that could pertain to both. And so I'm just not clear on that, and I would appreciate someone clarifying that. And I think also, I assume that everything that we're going to be including in terms of measures would be evidence-based, because this world, which looks wonderful, doesn't always have evidence for it. And so I'm sort of a little worried about making it very complex, but without the evidence for the specific issues.
So I think that the points that have been made are great. I think I'll touch on some of those things, but if Bruce or Aaron want to chime in on some of the questions that were raised, I think that, as it's been said, that this was meant to really sort of guide the development. And we have been thinking about the ways that and the methodologic issues for how you would adapt existing measures for use in people with multiple chronic conditions, how you would potentially change denominators, how you would potentially change exclusions, and how you might think about exception reporting, and have been thinking about the sort of the different levels of evidence that you need in order to think about that. But then I've also been trying to think about, and I think that this will come up later in the discussion, about things that are moving beyond our traditional set of moving beyond the measures that we already have. But we do have some already, like sort of cross-cutting non-disease specific types of measures of quality, and trying to capture them as well. But we also thought that there would be value in trying to figure out what measures need to be developed. And I think that your point is absolutely right, that we don't always have the evidence for all of the, when you would line up three different things and imagine a specific set of conditions in the middle, that we don't necessarily have the evidence to do that. And I think that's something that we would very much want to highlight and continue to call out, because the implications of that are, is if you're using existing measures that are based on an evidence base that's not actually relevant to these patients, we actually may be doing more harm than good. And so I think that is absolutely something that we would want to highlight or call out. And I think an example of that and the types of things that are ongoing might actually relate to your question about screening and prevention, which I actually think is really a great one. But there's been work at the VA in San Francisco led by Louise Walter and her colleagues about thinking about, well, can we change the way that we measure when we do screening, so that we actually are not, we are measuring whether you screen people that you shouldn't be screening. And so that sort of is the other side about screening and prevention. I think we would absolutely agree that some parts of screening and prevention probably that should be diminished in some patients with multiple chronic conditions, but perhaps that's we want to measure that as, you know, a type of potential harm to those patients if you're doing procedures on them that they aren't going to benefit from and that they may get harmed from. And I think that in people with multiple chronic conditions, just one final point, is that there may be different screening and prevention that we want to do. So, for instance, thinking about falls. So maybe it's not the same thing in someone else, but all of Mary Cinetti's fabulous work about falls. Like, so that we might be thinking about different types of screening and prevention than we traditionally might put in that bucket.
I just wanted to say one other thing, commenting a little bit on what Barbara was saying about where is the emphasis, should everything be emphasized equally. I view this as a straw man that can then be adapted for whatever particular combination of chronic conditions that you're looking at. So if you have a, you know, maybe you're dealing with someone who has multiple chronic conditions relating to cardiovascular health and high blood pressure and things like that, it's going to look different than if you're dealing with someone who has a child who has cystic fibrosis, or if you're dealing with someone who has substance abuse issues. It's going to look slightly different in terms of what are the domains that are going to be on there, what is the emphasis of the different domains, and sort of trying to find one.